Yes, it's Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis with you once again, filling in for Jeff Blair, who has yet another two-hour edition of Baseball Central coming your way at 5 o'clock with Kevin Barker. And this week, I'm with Stephen Brunt, who's in Newfoundland. But I heard your voice on Friday, Stephen, before the first Blue Jays home game in 670 days. And like you've often done over the last year and a half, every time I hear your voice on television, I get all choked up. So I hope there's no Pavlovian response here for these 3 hours where I hear your voice and I can't contain the tears.
We will. I hope that doesn't happen. That could make for a long show. But yeah, it was fun. You know, it was weird producing that piece from here because, you know, I did set off for the my other home here, not exactly knowing when or if the Blue Jays would make it back to the Rogers Center this year. So it required a few leaps in technology, but I watched that game from afar. I'll tell you, it sounds corny, but
yeah.
You know, watching it on TV from here and kind of reflecting on the whole year and a half and what it's been like, and going back to the day in spring training when they locked the gates, when Blair and I were down there doing this show, and yep, they padlocked the gates and said, we'll be gone for 2 weeks. You know, we're pushing opening day back for 2 weeks. Yeah. It was pretty emotional. You know, 15,000 people seemed like 150,000 people, and it felt really good. I wish I could have been there. Yeah. I will be in that ballpark as soon as I possibly can when I get back.
Yeah, I wish I was there on Friday. I was there on Saturday, but I was there on Saturday with my two kids, my wife, my in-laws, my dad, and I was running around getting people food before the games. It was tough to really soak in the moment emotionally. I'm going back tonight, though, with J.D. Bunkus and some other people here from the station. Maybe that'll be my breakdown moment, but I'm with you, yeah, because it's only 15,000 people in the building, but the type of person that would purchase a ticket at this point in time to be one of the 15,000 are the hardest of hardcores. And it really, like, we've both been down to the ballpark when there's 15,000 against the Rays on a Monday, 10 years ago. It doesn't feel like that type of 15,000. I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually, because, yeah, 15,000 with the whole building open on a Tuesday night against, yep, somebody when it doesn't matter and the team's not in contention, and you look around and say, boy, this place, I remember this place used to be full. But that 15, yeah, they were pretty engaged, and they have been pretty engaged. But, you know, look, it's a fun team right now. I'm not sure what the sum total of it's going to be this season, but they're a fun team to watch. There's, you know, lots of hope is a, you know, what's the commodity you sell in sports? It's hope.
Yeah.
There's lots of hope attached to this team, not just this year, but beyond. They're personality-wise, they're a really likable bunch. And, you know, you just keep going through. Like I heard on the update, they're talking about how, you know, this is, you forget that Ryu, you know, biggest free agent pitcher signing in history of the team,
yep,
has never pitched in the building.
Nope.
His Rogers Center debut. So there's a lot of, yeah, it does kind of feel fresh and new as well, which is, you know, that's always cool. It's like the beginning of any baseball season, except some multiple of that.
Yeah, and it felt like opening day on Friday. Let's start here then. We'll get to Kyle Lowry maybe for a little bit at the end of this segment. But Friday was about the craziest Major League Baseball trade deadline. That was before the historic return home for the Blue Jays, first home game in 670 days. Before that, it was literally by the numbers the most active Major League Baseball trade deadline in history. 15 All-Stars moved on the day. I think it was like 25 total, but 15 moved on Friday. And the Blue Jays got one, two-time All-Star in Jose Berríos. And the timing was really, really interesting. Not just the deadline acquisition, but the timeline in this franchise's ascension, making the playoffs last year, being in the second wild card race in the American League, but the top of the division being such a large hill to climb, Stephen. I wonder what your thought was giving up the number one and number four prospect in this organization for a guy who's not a rental, but there's only a year attached.
Yeah, well, that last part is a big part of it. But I'll say, like, I was on with our Calgary station the morning of that, and I boldly predicted that I didn't think they would do anything all that dramatic, that they would kind of be working around the edges.
Whoops.
As they had been heading up to this deadline. So, yeah, I was wrong. So I'm not going to come on here and say, yeah, I absolutely called it. I didn't. And if you'd said to me beforehand what it's going to cost, you're like, look, Berríos, if you looked at what the marketplace was, the number of sellers, the number of buyers, and the, you know, it's him and Scherzer, right, in terms of starting pitchers. If you wanted a, You wanted a guy at the front of the rotation, the starting pitcher. There were only two guys who were obviously available, and the price was obviously going to be high for both of them. So, I didn't know if they would, if the Jays, if Ross Atkins would be willing to go all in on a guy like that this year. There are a bunch of reasons why you might be, and why he presumably was. You know, that extra year of control is huge, because mm-hmm. next year is a big year for this team. I think, you know, I don't want to overplay the kind of the intangible message to the clubhouse, support for the guys who played hard for you and gone through all of the crap that they've gone through in the last year and a half. But, like, I was around the team in 2014 when, you know, the famous trade deadline when they didn't do anything because they didn't have any money, mm-hmm. you know, and you can blame ownership for that and say they should have given them more money, or you can blame Alex Anthopoulos for not, you know, having a little bit in reserve. But that, you know, that was kind of a good team of veteran guys who weren't necessarily going to be a postseason team, but maybe could have long shot. And it soured. That was kind of a sour clubhouse sometimes anyway, but mm-hmm. it really did sour things. So I think there's something to that. You know, like I do think that there's something to supporting the guys who have done what they have done for you. And it's not just about, like, you can do the math and say, well, they've got to play 627 ball for the rest of the season to have a realistic shot at the wild card. Well, but teams do that, right? In baseball, you could do that for 2 months. It's happened a million times in baseball. And if you waited for the absolute certain time to do it, then you probably would never pull the trigger. But yeah, no, there's risk associated. There's cost. You don't get something for nothing. I guess the one thing I would go back to, Ben, is that, you know, the 2015 deadline deals that Alex Anthopoulos, the historic 2015 deadline. You look at the guys they gave up for Tulowitzki.
Yeah.
You know, look at David Price. And the only guy who amounted to a hill of beans in that group was Matthew Boyd. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy who was the least.
I went with my wife, and the game was over. I don't think a note was recorded. He gave up six runs against the Red Sox. I was not imagining Matthew Boyd would be the guy that had the value.
Well, that's it, right? No, you're sitting there saying, oh, my God, they gave up. You know, they gave up this guy. It's like when they gave up Franklin Barreto in the Donaldson deal.
Right.
You know? And Donaldson's great, but, geez, Franklin Barreto is going to be a superstar, right?
Yeah.
He's going to be Alex Rodriguez. You got to know your own guys better than the other guys know your own guys. And, you know, sometimes, even if you do, and even if, you know, you guys are blue chippers, a lot of them, you know, it's different between baseball and a lot of sports, right? It takes time, and some of them plateau, and some of them don't pan out. So Austin Martin might turn into a superstar. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, if you put Ross Atkins on a lie detector, he wouldn't know either.
Yeah.
But you calculate, and you ought to have a better knowledge of where they are and what their potential is than the guys you're dealing them to.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and that's, so you that little bit of knowledge ought to be an advantage. I'm not saying they, you know, they sold damaged goods here or anything, but, you know, and you look at the, you know, you look at where they might get blocked in the organization. Obviously, a pitcher's not going to get blocked, but,
no.
You know, where you already have kind of an overabundance of talent. And one reason you accumulate, you know, you build prospect capital, and you build a farm system is to do exactly this. It's not, they're not all going to play for you. Doesn't happen.
No, I've done a good job downplaying Austin Martin, who he is as a prospect in my mind. I've done a great job of it. I've read all the negative, the hit pieces on him, and they're not really hit pieces. But, yeah, there's questions about his defense. There's questions about the power. Clearly, there's still the potential of an average to above major league player in there, if not an all-star caliber player. That's why the Twins gave up a two-time all-star pitcher, maybe the most coveted starting pitcher out there outside of Max Scherzer with another year of control. But yeah, we do this. We hug prospects. We think they're all going to pan out. The Blue Jays have already had, they've already lucked out as far as the prospects. And I know the people like to dump on Kevin Biggio, that he's made it this far, that he's made it to the major leagues as maybe it's just a bench utility piece. That was a guy who was not expected to be a major league player at all early in his professional baseball tenure. He was supposed to be just an organizational guy. Bo Bichette, there were legitimate questions about his his bat path, his swing. He's turned himself into an all-star. The idea that you just keep pumping out these success stories is probably a fallacy.
Yeah, well, and yes, and some of them, you know, some of that's great scouting and all of that stuff and great analysis, and some of it's dumb luck. You know, it just is. Like, and you know, and with the Austin Martin thing, of course, you have to also erase the Keith Law stuff from last year, where he said he was actually the best prospect in the entire draft, right?
Yeah.
So just erase that from your memory banks too.
But
you know, look at a guy like Alek Manoah. You know, again, a high pick, obviously, but you know, college pitcher. If you looked at the kind of pre-draft reports on Alek Manoah, there'd be a wide range of opinions about what he was going to wind up as. Is he going to be a back of the rotation guy? Is he a bullpen guy down the road? And, you know, as of right now, he's leapfrogged Nate Pearson, and he looks like he could be a front of the rotation guy. I could go back through Blue Jays history and come up with a list of guys who were, you know, who were the opposite, and who, you know, look at a guy like Daniel Norris again, who went over in the Tigers trade for David Price,
yeah,
or Jeff Hoffman,
yeah,
whose tires were pumped dramatically by the organization, but I think, you know, they really liked him, mm-hmm, and he went over in the Tulowitzki deal. I remember the reports coming from the farm about Jeff Hoffman, and you know, Jeff Hoffman has never been able to, you know, kind of anchor himself in the major leagues. I think he may just, you know, fall away completely at any moment. Daniel Norris had some, you know, health issues, but he's a bullpen guy. He's a depth bullpen piece right now. He's not even really a leverage guy. So, yeah, it's, you know, even the best minds of baseball get it wrong sometimes.
Yeah.
But, and sometimes and the other thing has been sometimes, like in Barrios, you get a guy who, you know, again, knock on wood from a Blue Jays point of view, but has been as consistent and durable as just about anybody of his level in baseball. You know, he shows up. You know, he shows up for his turn in the rotation. He throws lots of innings. He's very consistent. Lots of swing and miss. You know, that's and he's what, 27?
Yeah.
So you're not way out on a limb there. You know, that's not a kind of a hope for a guy. It's he's as much of a sure thing as you could possibly find in the market.
Yep, and they've, as you mentioned, set themselves up for a tremendous amount of pressure next season, this front office has, because that's the extent of the Barrios team control. Hyunjin Ryu will be in the second last year of his four-year deal. That's why, okay, so it's a lot of pressure is on next year. There's no question about that. If the goal this year is to play meaningful baseball into August and maybe into September and be right there and hopefully make the playoffs, that's all well and good. It's not a nightmare of nightmare to miss the second wild card. You're four games out right now, and you do still have 24 games against the Red Sox, Yankees, Rays, White Sox, and A's. But that does mean 35 games against teams that aren't those, that are the lesser lights. They have a ton of Orioles games left. They have all of their Tigers games left, which don't look as good as they did early in the season. The Tigers have taken a bit of a step forward. They have all of their Twins games left. They have a series against the Nationals. There's a lot of jetsam and floatsam coming up here in the final 2 months of the season. It's just the timing of this thing is very curious, Stephen, because you split the series, the four-game series against the Red Sox coming into this 10-game homestand, which was the bare minimum. It really looked like things were going to go seriously pear-shaped the way they blew the first game of that series. But you split that series. There would have been a legitimate case, especially considering the prices that some of these available players were going for, and not just players with years of control, rental players. If the Blue Jays truly did believe that they had no chance of re-signing Marcus Semien or a Robbie Ray, the amount they could have potentially gotten in return for those gentlemen if they made them available on Friday, they didn't. Instead, they said, we're not out of it this season, which is, it's a curious one because you can keep pointing to run differential, run differential, run differential, and I keep doing that because it is so, it's so much higher than their actual record. But at a certain point, the record is what it is, and it is against those teams that you're chasing as well. It's 10 games below 500 against teams with a winning record that they've, okay, made the calculation for 2022. That's one thing. But they're not writing off this season as a potential playoff season.
No, and I don't think they should. You know, I think there's reason to believe the team is, you know, you are what your record says you are, but there's reason to believe that, you know, with a little bit of better fortune and a little bit better bullpen performance in a few games that they would be right in the thick of it as opposed to on the fringes. I think that's a reasonable assessment. And, you know, in terms of selling, yeah, they would have got, you know, Robbie Ray would have, you know, as a rental would have got them something, and Semien would have got them something as a rental, although position players as rentals are trickier because you know, you got to need that position. You got to be a contender that has an area of need. But I, you know, again, I would, if you look at the pure rental market, it's not, you don't necessarily get game changing prospects out of that. So, you know, sometimes the calculation is better. It's better to take the qualifying offer, mm-hmm. you know, and the, compensation round draft pick, you know, or put out the qualifying offer and take the compensation round draft pick. It's almost as, you know, it's arguable that that's going to be as valuable as what you'd get back in a trade. But I just think that they couldn't punt on this season. Mm-hmm. You know, you just for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, you couldn't punt on this season coming back to Toronto. You couldn't punt on this season with the way, you know, it, you know, with a guy in the middle of an MVP. You know, he's not going to win the MVP because of Ohtani, but a guy who's having an MVP season, you know, with all of that kind of good, positive culture you're creating, which these guys care about. And, you know, you can be cynical about it if you want, but, you know, they believe in it. A lot of teams believe in it. I just didn't think that was really an option. You know, yeah. I saw the kind of, they should be sellers, not buyers. No. Mm-hmm. And there's no financial imperative for them to be sellers, right? This is, I think they're going to be a very aggressive the next offseason. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and anybody who's rolling their eyes about that, well, look at the previous two offseasons.
Right.
You know, they got the best starter on the market 2 years ago, and they got the second best starter on the market 2 years ago, and they got the best position player on the market last year. Yeah, that's, they're putting their money where their mouth is. You can't argue with that.
No. Yeah, and you can't argue with the results right out of the gate. They win 3 out of 4, including a sweep of, I think, a very moribund Kansas City Royals team. I think they're pretty much packing it in for the rest of the season. We'll see what Cleveland has in store. We know that bullpen pretty damn good, and they can pitch it pretty well. Offense couldn't do much yesterday. We'll see if they bounce back today. We'll talk to Joe Siddall in a little bit, but I do want to get your thoughts on Kyle Lowry, who the Raptors broke up with all over again today. I think most people had made their peace with this being the end game for Kyle as a member of the Toronto Raptors in the middle of the spring when he played. I don't even think he played in that Nuggets game, but went through the tunnel and had a little gesture for the camera. I think most people did their reminiscing about the Kyle Lowry era at that point. Then they don't move him. Yeah. And then they don't take the point guard in the draft and Jalen Suggs. And you're thinking, okay, well, they take the project forward. Maybe they do bring back the aged Kyle Lowry to usher this team into the new era of Scotty Barnes. Nope. It looks like it's a sign and trade, which hasn't been officially consummated, but it looks like Goran Dragic, Precious Achiuwa, and a second round pick. Where are your thoughts on the Kyle Lowry legacy and just where we've been the last few months with Kyle?
Well, I think you're right, Ben. The mourning process has already taken place, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, which happens in life sometimes, right? That you know, the something becomes apparent, and even if it hasn't happened yet, you kind of, the mourning begins, and the, you know, you go through all of the stages of it. And I think that all happened around the deadline, and everybody kind of wrapped their heads around the fact that this was, you know, potentially the end of, you know, of an era. You know, not like they're going to tear the team down, but the end of the greatest era in the history of the franchise, in period, and the departure of the greatest player in the history of the franchise. And yes, Vince Carter, yes, Chris Bosh, but, you know, there's not going to be much argument about where he belongs in Raptors history. You know, that championship was achieved with a whole bunch of pieces, and probably would not have been achieved without the addition of Kawhi Leonard that one year. But this, you know, he kind of embodied the Raptors team that found a way to not fold up in the playoffs as they had historically. You know, all those years, and, you know, he was part of some of those years where, you know, they couldn't get over a hump, or they lost to somebody they shouldn't lose to, or they lost to LeBron when he was in the division. And that sense of, you know, kind of the sense of futility that they could only go so far. And every Raptors fan has a boatload of memories of games where he kind of, you know, skilled his way to games, but also willed that team to victory at times. You know, tough, you know, tenacious, competitive. You know, there were nights when he didn't have it, and he still was falling all over the floor, going for loose balls and doing all that kind of stuff. That, you know, and for a guy who came to town as the rep, you know, I was reading both Grange and Smitty today on, you know, who both wrote really good pieces. You know, a guy who came to town with a reputation as kind of a malcontent, mm-hmm. and a coach killer, and, you know, and was kind of surly and miserable, and he hated DeMar, didn't want to talk to DeMar DeRozan, and, you know, Dwayne Casey, nicest man in the world, couldn't get along with him. And, you know, it's quite a transformation. I guess the one thing, Ben, that I, And again, this is Celebrate Kyle Lowry Day, and it should be, and maybe it's the consummation of Celebrate Kyle Lowry weeks, but the Eastern Conference, a different Raptors kind of team is going to emerge here at some point, with some of the familiar faces, but also some different ones. But the Eastern Conference looks pretty daunting right now, does it not?
Absolutely, including
the defending NBA champions. Brooklyn with those three guys if they get healthy, Miami with Kyle Lowry.
Mm-hmm.
We're not even mentioning the Phillies or the Bostons or because there's uncertainty there, but
mm-hmm.
this climbing at the top of even that mountain again is going to be very, very tough in the near future.
Yeah, I am curious to see what is left to play out for the Raptors this offseason, because at the moment, not very awe-inspiring. When you project wins and losses for 2021-22, when your big acquisition is Sam Dekker and maybe Goran Dragic, but a guy that you're probably flipping, and Precious Achiuwa, who I think averaged 5 points a game a season ago, and he's a project, and you draft a guy who's probably not going to be as impactful this season as he will be down mm-hmm. the line. That's what you're hoping for. And you got Pascal Siakam, your best player, not returning till Christmas, maybe. So, yeah. It'll be nice to have the Raptors home, but their plan for this year as far as wins and losses seems to be maybe you take the under if you're into gambling on futures, would be my take at this
yeah,
point.
I hate to be like negative in August about a basketball season, and it's not negative in the grand scheme of things because, people have a lot of, rightly have a lot of faith in that front office.
Yeah.
And their ability to put things together, and this page did have to turn eventually. So that's not that shocking. But if I was asked today, I would say they're probably a playoff team.
Mm-hmm.
But that list of teams, I didn't include Atlanta there. Yep. Who I would add to that list as well, right? Are they a sixth place team or a seventh place team? Are they in a play-in game like they were this year? It's going to be two steps back again, right? Or a step and a half back before the steps forward start. And it's going to be a slightly different blueprint than the one that, came together so perfectly. I'm not being negative because I, like everybody else, I have a lot of faith that mm-hmm. they know what they're doing. And, you couldn't hold on to the Kyle Lowry, there wasn't going to be Kyle Lowry forever. But we are in a transitional phase with this team. There's no question about it.
Yep. No doubt about that. All right. Blue Jays continuing their series against Cleveland tonight. There's a very interesting statistic floating out there as far as the Blue Jays offense in close and late situations. Not only is the bullpen disappointed late in games, but the bats have struggled against the best relievers in baseball. We'll talk to Joe Siddall about that. Plenty more next. Blue Jays Central analyst Joe Siddall joins us in a second. It is Writer's Block. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair. Alongside Stephen Brunt, it's Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. Hyunjin Ryu getting set to make his Rogers Center debut as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. Let's talk to Joe Siddall, Blue Jays Central analyst. And thanks to Kevin Glue on Twitter, who alerts me to this fact. 28 years ago, Windsor's Joe Siddall registering his first major league hit when he singles to center field of Mets lefty Frank Tanana in the fourth inning in the Expos 3-1 win at the Big O. Montreal Gazette said you shyly doffed your batting helmet when you reached first base. Can you confirm, Joe?
Yeah, my first base coach told me to do it, and I was like, sure, I did.
Shyly.
Just a lousy single,
Hey, man, one more than I've got in the major leagues of baseball. You've actually been down to the ballpark, which must feel amazing. I know it's felt amazing for me to just return back to the studio, feel some restored sense of normalcy. You were with this team in 2015. You were covering them. Do you think being at home, the excitement of the trade deadline, is there a comparable atmosphere to that 2015 team that went on that ridiculous run at the back end of the season?
Well, yeah, it's just the excitement surrounding the team, especially Friday there when they came home and then trade deadline. And when you land a big fish like Barrios, it all came to a head. And I thought the Blue Jays did a fantastic job with all of the ceremonies and how it all went. And really, for an opening night at home and opening weekend, it could not have gone better for Charlie and his club. A little better, could have been a little better yesterday, but it was a fantastic weekend. And I was shocked, guys. I was not anticipating a top of the rotation arm. I was preaching it. I was hoping for it, but I realistically was not expecting it. I thought they would just maybe make some more ads like the Simber and Richards ad, just those kind of mid-range type relievers or a starter to hopefully solidify things to try to help them make a run. I was not expecting this. So I was as thrilled as anyone. It was a lot of fun. Of course, great fun to watch him pitch the other day.
Yeah, I'm with you, Joe. Look, I was on the record as saying it wasn't going to happen. So there you go. that's what I know. But what do you think? What do you think? You know, like it. Berríos is you cannot argue with Berríos, both, you know, in terms of value this season and next season, but also, you know, consistency. I was saying to Ben, talking to Ben earlier in the last segment, he has been extraordinarily consistent and extraordinarily durable, which are two good things. But the cost benefit analysis, you know, people fall in love. There's way more talk about prospects these days than there was back in the day. There's way more people rating them and analyzing them and coming up with their top hundreds and top 50s. They paid a pretty high price for a very good ball player. But, you know, what do you think about them making that particular move at this particular time in the evolution of the team?
I loved it, Steven. And the reason I loved it is because you're getting a known for a couple of unknowns. And I know they're top prospects and they're highly regarded and they may both go on to be very good big leaguers. Nobody really knows that. That's the craziness of baseball, right? It's so hard. I think anybody that tells you that they have the art of evaluating down, they're lying to you, because it is a crapshoot. We see it with the baseball draft every year as top prospects either go on and develop into all-stars at the big league level or don't develop at all. So, but for this team right now, you're getting a guy that this team, are they in it? Yes, they're on the outside looking in, and that's why I didn't think they'd make the splash like this. But he adds that consistency along with what Ray and Ryu looks like. He's back to being him. This rotation, Manoah keeps doing his thing. It's really becoming a strength. And then now you look at the bullpen, and sure, there are some hiccups. They're always going to happen, but it just looks very different than it did just a short while ago. Now all of a sudden I'm looking at the pitching saying you feel pretty good about it. And you have to assume the lineup is going to do their thing. But I think when you add Berríos for a run this year, and then we all probably have talked about it, that 2022 is probably more realistic, depending on what they do, and I'm sure we can expect more things to happen this winter with this roster. But I think that's more the year that they're going to, I don't know if we use the term all in, but the kind of year we've been all pointing to for the last couple of seasons. So it was a great move. Any time you get a known, not just a known big leaguer that's been in the big leagues for a year or two, this guy's been doing it year in and year out. I think you know exactly what Berríos is, and that's a really good, as you said, durable and steady starting pitcher.
Yeah, and he gets another AL Central opponent, an opponent he knows very well, and not exactly the 27 Yankees in the Kansas City Royals. To get his debut out of the way, and he hits three batters. I loved your breakdown on Sportsnet.ca about pitching inside and how necessary it is and how it's not the worst thing in the world to clip the odd batter or two. I wonder, though, how you think his stuff will play in this division, because this ain't the AL Central, and his numbers against the Yankees, Red Sox, and Rays are, I mean, pedestrian against some and bad against some of the others. Well, how do you think his stuff plays in this division against the big boys?
Well, I think it plays because of what I see coming out of his hand. Now, it is interesting that some of these teams have fared well against him. Is it a concern? Sure. But I still take my chances because, you know, teams' rosters change year to year. And I think with what he is doing, he's continued to be very, very good. And the combination is a fascinating one. And, you know, I kind of joked tongue-in-cheek about hitting guys. I don't care if you hit people, but honestly, you don't, because if you pitch inside effectively, you're going to once in a while. And it's the pitchers that try to come inside at times, and we've seen, like, say, a Steven Matz do it and not get it in there. And when they miss on the plate instead of in off the plate, and that's when the damage is done, especially against dangerous hitters. So I just love his approach, and that breaking ball is ridiculous. It's like a frisbee horizontal big break. He changes it. He can change the break on it, which is fascinating. He does have the four-seam fastball also that he'll use more up in the zone. So he's got some weapons. The third weapon is that changeup, and we saw it a little bit. And I think from what I had heard coming in, that once he has gained more confidence in that pitch, he'll use it more. So He's got three great weapons. I would take him against anybody, to be honest with you. So it'd be interesting to see what he does face the big boys here in the East. And I do not see why that doesn't play, though.
What do you, you know, Joe, you're talking 2015, they made, obviously, they had the big, huge deadline, but they were a 500 team to that point. And, you know, and yes, Price and Tulowitzki and Ben Revere and LaTroy Hawkins, right? But something else kind of like a switch flipped with that team. It felt like they didn't lose in August and September at all, which is kind of what these guys would have to do this year to make the postseason, right? They're going to have to play, you know, 600-something baseball. It can happen. But, you know, in addition to, I guess, you know, like it's not like you, you know, add up the war value of those guys and say, well, it's obvious it's going to happen. Sometimes a team changes. You know, the personality of that team changed. Do you know why that, you know, again, you can't bottle it, but, put it this way. Do you see the potential for these guys who overflow with confidence and youth and energy to, you know, kind of get on one of those roles where, you know, they fall behind and they come back, where everybody picks everybody else up, which is what it felt like in 2015?
Yeah, I feel that they can. And when I think of 15, Stephen, all I think of is star power. I remember being in my place when I saw it come across the ticker on TV that the Blue Jays acquired Troy Tulowitzki, and I almost fell off the couch like, holy cow, Troy Tulowitzki. And I mean, really, he was the turning point. We can point to a lot of other things too, but he made every play at shortstop. And remember all the problems at shortstop that season. He made every play for 2 months, and that made a huge difference defensively. It made a huge difference for the pitchers, made a huge difference for everyone. And I think on this team, when you solidify starting pitching with a guy like Berríos, and we're assuming that Bay and Ryu are going to keep doing their thing, and Manoah is still going to be pretty darn good, that's a starting rotation that I'll take any day going down the stretch here. And I'm a big fan of starting pitching. I've said it from day one. I think starting pitching is critical because it makes life a lot easier for everybody down that bullpen. It allows you to maybe avoid some of the weaknesses that a reliever might have. If it's a reliever that's not very good pitching 2 to 3 days, then you don't do it. If it's a reliever that likes to pitch a little bit more, then you can do it. But you can treat guys the way that they're going to put them in the best positions to succeed. When your starters are going 3 1/3 and 4 1/3, you're getting everybody out of their roles. So regardless of how good the guys are down there, I think you got a chance at least to utilize them to the best of their abilities to have success. So starting pitching is everything for me. And these guys, I mean, every night now, you just throw the starting pitcher's name out there. And, you know, it's the old Charlie's old quote is you give us a chance to win. But it's an old quote, but it's so true. That's what good starters do.
Yeah, and they've remade the bullpen, and that was a necessity. And the offense is still good. In fact, they lead all of Major League Baseball with a 784 OPS. But this one's weird, Joe. And we're talking to Joe Snell.
Yeah.
Okay, so late and close. I just said, the top team, OPS, in all of baseball, overall, number one, late and close. They're 26. 632 OPS. Is that because, okay, Major League Baseball season is a big sample, but in you can have weird one-off samples where things get skewed for an unknown reason. Is there a reason to it? Is there something you can put your finger on as to the failures of this offense at times, late and close?
Well, I think one thing you can look at, maybe I'm just guessing, maybe is experience. I think not too long ago, we were talking about how deep this lineup was because everybody was hitting, right? That's when Gurriel was swinging pretty good. Grichuk was rolling. And, you know, they were doing pretty good at that bottom part of the order. And that's when Biggio had come back from his injury. He was swinging it, but it's kind of thinned out, right, if you think about it. So now you go 1 through 5. You'll take your 5 big boys any day of the week against anyone. But after that, that bottom half of the lineup is really thinning out when they start not really swinging it real well. We're starting to see that more and more now. So that's tough. But you want your big guys, of course, to be good in those situations. You expect them to be. And, I mean, Springer's not one of those young ones I'm talking about. He's a veteran. You know, he and Simeon up at the top of that order should be the veterans that can handle that. But I just think, too, especially when you're facing the higher velocity or better pitching late in ball games, then that bottom half of the lineup is really going to be susceptible because they're going to probably do their damage. Like we know this lineup does a lot of damage, probably against those mid-range, say, starting pitchers. They do a lot of damage. But then when you face, hate to say Eli Morgan, but Eli Morgan yesterday did it to him. But when they face that tough starter and then heavy-duty reliever guys, that's how it changes everything. But I expect the top half of the order still to do their thing. Hey, is Teoscar susceptible to Chase? Absolutely. you know, that's going to happen. But you think with Springer and Vladdy and Simeon and Bo, you got a pretty good foursome at least. So the top half, I'm not overly concerned about it. It's trying to be complete at all. And the bottom half has some glaring weaknesses when they cool off, and we've seen a lot of that lately.
Joe, speaking of the bottom half of that lineup, if Danny Jansen gets healthy before rosters expand on September 1st, and maybe he just won't, right? Because they can make that happen. He may not be available till September 1st roster expansion. But if they had to make a decision next week on Danny Jansen between him and Kirk, because I assume Reese McGuire, they're not going to DFA Reese McGuire the way he's been. You know, he's been very good this year. What would you do?
That's a really good question, Stephen, because I'm not crazy about any of the options back there. I've been a big proponent since last offseason of, you know, the veteran type catcher or a guy that can handle a pitching staff. We saw the pass ball by, you know, I call it a pass ball yesterday when Brad Hand came into the game because yeah. It was a catchable ball. That ball's not in the dirt. Mm-hmm. And I don't expect you can't expect a catcher to get down to his knees and block a fastball when it's 94. You just don't have time. But that ball is catchable, mm-hmm. and that to me was inexperienced. It's a new pitcher coming in. We talked about the shadows of the ballpark. There are a lot of things that play there, but those are the things that ramp up and speed up a game for a young catcher. So those are things. I'm not a great fan of him back there. He can hit. There's no question he's the best hitting catcher, and I know Reese has done some things, but I think we can agree that Kirk is best hitting catcher. So do you want offense? Do you want defense? I mean, I want defense. Danny the best defensive catcher, might be out of the three, but you know what, in answer to your question, if you do it to Reese, you got to DFA him, right? Because he's off mm-hmm. the roster. So to make the quick switch, you have Jano in there, and sure, you're not going to get a lot of offense maybe, but you want your most stable defender. That would make a lot of sense when your pitching has kind of stabilized. So that would make sense to have him replace Kirk, or even on a part-time basis until the next move has to be made. But it's a glaring, I think, weakness leading into next season. Let's put it that way. We're going fast forward.
Yeah, and it's tough when the bottom of your lineup, like we said, has not exactly been great. If you can throw a bat in there like Kirk, is it worth the defensive downgrade? I don't need to tell you where I stand on the matter because I can't shut up about Alejandro Kirk. And I will do so now, though. Corey Dickerson looks like he's going to be activated at some point today, Joe. Maybe that helps alleviate some of the problems at the bottom of this lineup, especially against righties. He's not a big on-base guy, but big power, kind of like a slightly better Randall Grichuk, except a lefty power bat. How do you see him factoring in here? Is he an everyday guy against righties to start?
I think he'd be against righties. I think he'd be that kind of guy, and it's just that left-handed bat that we've talked about so much, and, you know, going back to being close to acquiring Michael Brantley in the offseason, that would have been a gem for sure. But they're missing that, and I know it's a right-handed lineup that hits righties very well, and that makes sense. But at the same time, when you try to, and I haven't done it in detail, but you try to extrapolate some of those numbers, I think they've beat up on some of those marginal right-handers, right? You can pad your numbers a lot, but how are you doing against the upper end or top tier type right-handers? That's probably going to neutralize that lineup a little bit more. They do hit them, I know, but it makes it tougher. So to have that left-handed bat not only playing, but maybe even on the bench at times. So then you have that bat on the bench. And Charlie talked about that yesterday a little bit. You know, you think about the Rays, and of course we keep talking about the Rays because they just seem to have this game down to a science. But when you have that bat on the bench, now it forces the other manager to think about what he's going to do with his bullpen. You know, am I going to go to my bench for this guy when you've got, say, a Dickerson bat on the bench? So it just gives you more options. So I think he'll certainly play against righties. Does it get a little crowded? Yeah, but I still think, you know, I think Biggio's time is going to be, you know, he and Espinal at third base, or that's going to be whether they keep platooning or kind of doing whatever they're doing, but they're just really scuffled. So yeah, that's not helping much. But I think, yeah, I think Dickerson fits into that fold. And if you've got one of Dickerson or Grichuk, or maybe it's a Gurriel day off, one of those guys on the bench, that's not a bad thing, right? That's now you're starting to have, I think, that stronger bench that we've always talked about.
Joe, we appreciate the time as always. Enjoy the game tonight.
All right, guys. Pleasure.
All right, see you later. There's Joe Siddall, Blue Jay Central analyst. And I wonder, Stephen, if the lack of a viable left-handed bat does impact that close and late OPS stat, that now that you have a Corey Dickerson to use at your disposal against hard-throwing righties in the eighth and ninth inning, I wonder if that's impactful, because that's huge. That's a massive discrepancy. First in OPS versus 26th in OPS in close and late. There has to be something to it.
Well, there's, you know, there just hasn't been, because they've gone with a short bench anyway, there just haven't been a lot of options right off that bench. Well, let's see what Dickerson looks like. You know, I'm a little skeptical, but, you know, he is left-handed, and he at times has been a really good offensive player, and it's better than what Charlie Montoyo's had to reach for late in games before this. So I think just giving him a little bit more flexibility in terms of the bench and maybe not being, you know, like everybody, you understand why they were, the bullpen arms were being stacked on top of each other early in the season because none of them were any good, right? And they were trying to find somebody who was good. I think we're at a moment in the season where the roster construction is going to be a little bit different. And a left-handed power bat at the deadline would have been something, you know, if you asked me what the needs were, that would have been on my list. Whether Dickerson can be that, we'll see.
Yeah, Joey Gallo would have looked nice in a Blue Jays uniform.
Yeah, he would have been okay. Yeah, like him. Yeah, he would have been good.
Yeah, instead he's at that ballpark in the Bronx where you have to hit it 150 feet to hit a home run to right field. He'll do well there and has done well. All right, let's take a break. Come back with more of Writer's Block. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. It's Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. And not an early morning for Canadians who want to watch Canada's national women's soccer team play for gold against Sweden. We lucked out. 10 p.m. is the start. Well, you know what? Those of us in the Eastern time zone lucked out. Maybe not Stephen Brunt. He has to watch them at 11:30 Thursday night. But they finally made it. They beat the Americans for the first time in 20 years. I was going to say eliminate the memory of 2012 London. I don't know if anything will eliminate that memory and the way that semifinal match went down. But an incredible achievement. Christine Sinclair into the gold medal match and a chance to add yet another medal to what's been all about the Canadian women down in Tokyo, Stephen.
Yes, the Old Trafford screw job will not, that memory will linger, I believe, for anybody who remembers it.
We're going to have Karina LeBlanc on. I think she will say the same.
Yeah, crooked referee, you know, the whole bit. Like, that lingers. I will put my emotional cards on the table here. I've been covering Canadian women's national team since the 1999 World Cup. The first women's World Cup was 1991. So, you know, the sport was in its infancy. 10 years ago this summer, I was in Germany covering them in the World Cup, which was the most crushing defeat I've ever seen any team in any sport undergo. It just was brutal and horrible. And their own coach kind of just washed her hands of them and sat there and let them. It was appalling. And Christine Sinclair is, of all the athletes I've ever covered, she's my favorite for a whole bunch of reasons. So I'm rooting hard for this team this year. And it's funny, in these short tournaments, Ben, you know, like the Olympic tournament's different for whatever reason. They thrive there, but they haven't been great in this tournament, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been organized but, you know, they went to they gave up that late goal against Japan in the opening game. They went to the shootout against Brazil. Sink missed the first shot in the shootout. They could have lost that. Maybe, you know, should have lost that, really. And the Americans aren't, you know, they got smoked in that first game against Sweden. They're not their usual selves here for whatever reason. But I, you know, take nothing away. That was as satisfying, you know, watching them win that game against that team. And watching Christine Sinclair hand the ball to Jesse Fleming for that penalty. You know, that's one we'll be talking about for a while, because if it had gone the other way and she had not scored, we would have had different questions. But, you know, that for the greatest scorer in the history of that sport to say, I'm not feeling it, but I know you are, go do it. That's a hell of a decision to have to make. And she made it.
Yeah. And a 23-year-old taking the biggest penalty in the history of this program. It's a weird dynamic, too, because it feels so personal between those two teams, and there is certainly an element of it being personal. Megan Rapinoe, after the match, some very interesting comments about losing to Canada, which, I mean, hey, historically, she's right, doesn't happen to the Americans. But there's also a dynamic of some of these players being teammates in their professional league, but it really, yeah, there's a catharsis that is involved with that program being a couple of time bronze medalists, but beating that team and that history of 2012 in London still looming large to come away with it. You hope there's not a letdown in the gold medal game, and I can't imagine. It's a gold medal game, but that was almost as satisfying as winning a gold medal, because I don't know if they're going to be favored against Sweden.
No, I don't think they are. They should be, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, based on form in this tournament, I think Sweden, but that's not a concession. I'm just saying that's kind of, if you were handicapping it, I would say Sweden's the favorite going into this match. But yeah, beating the Americans, like, you can sit back and say, boy, they're a horrible, arrogant, swaggering bunch, aren't they? But if you had the run of success that they've had,
20 years.
You can do that, right? You're allowed, right? You can swagger all you want. But I remember when Sink, scored the goal, when she won, she took the scoring record away from Abby Wambach. And I remember asking her in an ear, trying to get her to say, boy, it was great, but it's really great that I knocked Abby Wambach out of the record book. And she finally said it, but it took about 9 questions to get there. And they do. Yeah, you're right. They play like Christine Sinclair lives in Portland, right?
Yep.
She's lived there for years. She plays professionally there. That's her professional home and her personal home now. She plays with all of those American players, or the vast majority of them in the NWSL. Like, yeah, they're pals off the, but this is, it's, sort of like the women's hockey thing, right? Except in that case, there's only 2 teams.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that, yeah, and this has been so one-sided. So that, yeah, that was not just change the color of the medal, right? That was like change history. And they deserve to have one go their way. Even if they took a break here and there, they deserved it. Thank God for VAR.
Oh man,
because that one never would have been called. No referees calling that without seeing it twice.
It was a little dicey even after VAR. I didn't hear any of the Americans complain about it, and certainly as a Canadian watching that thing, you have no qualms about it. But right on the edge of the box, and one that kind of looked like, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, whatever. We'll take it, right?
We'll take it.
That's for sure. The Miami Heat. We'll take Kyle Lowry from the Toronto Raptors. Had to stay in the Eastern Conference. Get to see him a whole bunch. His return to Scotiabank Arena will be an absolutely electric moment and a tough ticket to be had. We'll talk to a man who knows Mr. Lowry very well. Alvin Williams, former Raptors guard and Sportsnet analyst, joins us next. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair's Writer's Block with Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. And the next time you see Kyle Lowry, he will be in a Miami Heat uniform as the Raptors and Heat reportedly agreeing to a sign-and-trade 3-year, $90 million deal. Goran Dragic, Precious Achiuwa, and a second-round pick returning to the Raptors. Let's talk to a man who knows Mr. Lowry very well, Alvin Williams, former Raptors guard. Sportsnet analyst joins us online right now. Alvin, how's it going? What's the Kyle moment that's gonna stick out in your mind when you think back at his tenure with the Toronto Raptors?
How you guys doing, first of all? But a lot, man, a lot, because I remember still working for the organization when we were going through talks about acquiring Kyle, via trade. It was that feeling where we're going to go for a trade with Kyle Lowry or try to sign Steve Nash as a free agent. And it was going back and forth with that, and then even having conversations with Kyle about playing next to Steve Nash, and Kyle not having the greatest reputation at that moment of his career, was more than open to playing with Steve Nash. Felt that he can learn a lot from Steve Nash and really, really, really honored Steve Nash to a degree. So I remember thinking to that point of Kyle Lowry not being sure of what was going on to the Kyle Lowry we know today, who people put him as the greatest Raptor of all time. So him going through that process, the ups and downs, the criticisms, the championships. So many memories that I have and so many pieces from this time with Kyle personally, privately, and then even in the open. So a lot of things. I couldn't just pinpoint one thing.
That stuff about Steve Nash is really, that's fascinating, Alvin. So you saw him evolve. Obviously, you saw him evolve as a player in Toronto, but because you know him the way you know him, how did he evolve as a person in you know, during that time as a Raptor. You know, he arrived, as you say, he arrived at the team as a bit of a reputation of a, you know, a bit of a malcontent. He'd bounced, you know, third team, hard guy to coach, didn't get along with DeMar DeRozan at first, didn't get along with Dwayne Casey at first. You know, a difficult guy was his rep. And he leaves here as the, with a reputation as a guy who wore his heart on his sleeve, gave everything for the team, ultimate team guy and a champion. How, you know, what does that say about his kind of personal evolution?
That's it. You named it. You know, him having that reputation. And once again, getting a chance to meet Kyle, you know, him being recruited by Villanova and my first interactions with him and getting to spend more and more time with him. And I think it basically came down to me having to adjust and respecting who he was as a young man and then him learning along the way. The one thing about Kyle is he's a forever learner. He is stuck in his ways and he has the chip on his shoulder, but he realizes that. But he has a bigger interest in learning and growing. And I talk to him about business. I talk to him about family. I talk to him about athletics. I talk to him about giving back, community. And all of these things, he was already up on it. And it was just about him being in a space where he could continue to learn, surround himself around positive people and people that he can look up to. And he mentions it all the time, whether it's Damon Stoudemire, Chauncey Billups, someone like myself, being close with DeMar DeRozan, opening up enough where he can continue to grow. And that's the biggest, that transformation is the biggest accolade I can give to Kyle, him continue to grow as a man. And when you start having, you know, when you start accomplishing things that he's accomplished, whether it's all-star games, whether it's championships, Olympic gold medals, financially, it's easier to get into your own world and, you know, just forget everything and just is your way. But he didn't allow himself to do that. He continues to grow. He continued to use his resource. He becomes more of a resource for people. So personally, his growth is something that I've learned from personally, even I'm being older than he was. But I've learned a lot from him as well. And it's, a lot of people can learn from being that person that he started out. And it's not who will actually define you, continue to grow, and which he continues to do every day.
Hard worker, extremely hard worker. It's what you hear from everybody, including Nick Nurse. He says he's never met a harder worker in his days in the NBA. And whenever you talk about the Raptors and what they could accomplish, and you look at the names on the paper, people talk about culture, though. The culture of this Raptors team is what's going to allow them to surpass the accumulation of their parts. How responsible is Kyle Lowry for that culture? And how much does that culture lose out on not having the greatest Raptor of all time moving forward?
I mean, I think it goes hand in hand. I think you have to give a lot of credit to the Raptors organization, MLSE, because they've evolved as well. And with Kyle being here, because once again, and just being 100% honest, I remember Kyle wasn't the most liked person around the organization or maybe around the city, you know, maybe amongst his teammates. But everybody grew. And it was a great thing to see everyone grow together. And Kyle being a part of that, that culture begins, right? People start believing in Kyle. People start trusting him. Kyle has always been a hard worker. He's always been focused. But once again, he start changing as an individual, as a professional. He start understanding the game of business and sports other than just being on a court. And I also believe the franchise did a great job of sticking with Kyle. And although things, you know, transpired in the championships and all those things, and a lot of times wins, they mask the bad things that happens. But I think the result of Kyle being here and the organization having the pieces in place where everybody grew, you know, pretty much organically, that piece developed the culture. Not just Kyle. I think everyone part of it. I think of DeMar DeRozan. I think of Nick Nurse. I think of Dwayne Casey. I think of Masai. I think of everyone involved created that culture. Kyle could be the staple, but I don't think Kyle's departure will tarnish or do anything, you know, when you talk about the culture. I think that will remain the same as long as the principals and the people that are calling the shots have that same mindset.
Alvin, around the deadline, it's, you know, people have kind of reconciled themselves, you know, inside and outside, and, you know, the fans and the franchise and everybody kind of reconciled themselves to the idea that Kyle was probably gone. And it was almost like everybody said their goodbyes already. And, you know, we'd already had the tributes and then they didn't move him at the deadline. In hindsight, should they have moved him at the deadline?
No, I don't think so. And if you're talking about from an organization standpoint, and they feel like they may have not gotten enough for him or whatever the case may be, I wasn't in the rooms where the deals were going down, and you try to see what's the best deal that you can get for a Kyle Lowry. But I think when you move forward, Kyle's happy. The fan base has a great understanding of the business and everything that Kyle means to the team. And I think the organization, at the end of the day, with the leadership in place, always going to be okay because they have the right leadership in place and they're going to make the right moves for the organization. And that's the first and foremost, the biggest thing. So I wouldn't say they should have made that move early on. I think now is a great time. Everyone wants to get benefits. And then once again, it shows the growth of the city and the country as well, because I think back when Vince Carter and, you know, everyone else who left, whether it was Tracy or Chris, they weren't received that well, right? Of course, we didn't get the championships, but you know, I think everyone has a truer understanding of the business and everything that goes within it. So I think at the end of the day, everyone comes out on top with it.
Talking to Alvin Williams, do you think this allows the remaining Raptors to take over more of an ownership role on this team, whether that's Fred VanVleet, whether that's Pascal Siakam, that might have been more difficult to accomplish if Kyle Lowry is still there, the face of the franchise, the greatest Raptor of all time?
Yeah, of course. I mean, when you have Kyle there and the face of the franchise has been there, he's had the longest tenure. He's had, I mean, pretty much the most success, the most notoriety, but they got an excellent chance and opportunity to learn and see how Kyle went about his day to day. And more so just to see his professionalism when you're on the road, going out to dinner, when you're in Philadelphia, come over our house, when you're doing these things, those things are valued. That has so much value. So when you have a Fred and you have a Pascal and you have OG and you have some of the other people around that witnessed that and was a part of that, they get to see what leadership truly is. Now, it comes down to winning and it comes down to everything else. But those pieces, first and foremost, what it takes to be a leader and being selfless when you're not playing well, when things aren't going well, are you still conducting yourself as the leader and making sure everyone else comes first? Those are things Kyle learned to do. At first, he didn't have that. But he learned to make sure everybody was on the same page. He learned to make sure everybody, you know, was benefiting and getting better. And a lot of times he came last. He came second to that. So they had a great opportunity to learn from that. And they're going to have a chance to put it in the forefront now. And then once again, it comes down to getting those wins that make their leadership even look much better.
What's this, Alvin? What's this team? You know, it's been a long time since we've seen a Raptors team without Kyle Lowry. Well, like, what's this team going to look like beginning the new season without? Well, and they also have Pascal Siakam on the sidelines for a few weeks at the beginning of the season as well. But give us a sense of what, you know, as this page is turned, what is this team without him? And you know, what is it going to have to do to kind of write the next chapter?
It's going to look different, and I think more importantly, it's going to look different to us from the outside. When you're in that locker room and when you're in that training camp and you're getting ready for the summer, people are already preparing for their roles. People, you know, some people may even feel this is more of an opportunity for them. Malachi Flynn, you know, spent 1 year with Kyle, so may not have that exact connection that a Fred has, but, you know, Malachi has the opportunity to, you know, step into this thing and make a name for himself and continue to learn from someone like Fred. So I believe when you have someone like a Fred VanVleet, he's gonna do a lot of things that Kyle, and not putting that pressure on him, or Fred's his own man, but he has some things that he's learned from Kyle that he can implement or he can help Malachi Flynn as well. But it's going to look different. But trust me, the players are eager for this opportunity to carve their own niche and move forward. And I think it's a great opportunity. It's an exciting time for the organization to get past this chapter, because this has been something looming over, you know, their head for a while, right? Whether it's due to trade, whether it's before, all these things. So now you can clean slate with that position with Kyle gone. You know, you pay respect, you give his tributes, you have that honor and all that, but let's move forward and let's get going. And I think the Raptors are in good position to do that.
So he joins his buddy, Jimmy Butler. And a lot of people say the same things about Jimmy Butler that they do about Kyle Lowry. How do you think those two are going to mesh? Obviously, like, the personal relationship is going to make it a perfect fit in that regard. But I can imagine some heated practices, Alvin.
Yeah, for sure. Me not knowing Jimmy Butler at all, but knowing his reputation from what I hear and even talking to Kyle, very, very similar. Both start out as underdogs, both hard workers, both are dogs and very competitive. But the beautiful thing is they have respect for one another. So you don't have to go into a situation as a coach, if you're Eric Spoelstra or, you know, Miami Heat organization, worrying about how the two guys are going to get along, especially when you bring one in. And you don't have to worry about that, which a lot of organizations do. Those guys are going to respect each other, and that's just going to bring that team even much more leadership. Everyone around that team is going to benefit from a Jimmy Butler and a Kyle Lowry combination. Kyle Lowry really has a true understanding of leadership. He respects Jimmy Butler, and that was something else early on. Kyle Lowry didn't necessarily have respect for a lot of people, you know, at a younger age. He has that respect. So once again, you don't have to fight that battle with those two. So they're starting out guns blazing. They're starting out guns blazing, and I'm excited to see how that combination, along with the young fellas that they have, they work out.
Eastern Conference is going to be a bit of a beast, isn't it, Alvin? When you look ahead to next season, you know, they're starting with the champions and working your way down.
Oh my God, yes, it truly is. Because if you look at it, people, and I won't say people, I will put myself, I'll stand on it. I was high on Milwaukee the past 2-3 years. Even when the Raptors won the championship, I was high on Milwaukee, and they just kind of fizzled out. And then, you know, they popped out of nowhere. They made the trade for Drew Holiday, Chris Middleton. You know, he developed into that guy that if Giannis is not playing well, then he can be that other guy. And they just came together, and they went through the process. But Brooklyn Nets was on their last leg, and they still battled. You know, Philadelphia 76ers, they have to make some adjustments, but, you know, they still a talented team. So now you got the Miami Heat. New York Knicks popped out of nowhere, Atlanta Hawks. So I think from 1 to 8, it's going to resemble a lot how the West, you know, looked for years, 1 through 8. It was always some type of competition there. So the East, to your point, Steve, it's going to be really, really competitive.
You think there's a few teams in that East? I mean, maybe not the Heat, because they get swept in the first round by the eventual champs. But the Sixers, we know how close they were to acquiring Kyle, according to rumors, at the deadline last year. We know the Lakers were thinking about a trade for Kyle Lowry. You think there's more than a few teams that wish they could have turned back the clock and maybe ponied up the extra that Masai Ujiri wanted and consummated a Kyle Lowry trade at the deadline last year?
Yeah, I mean, once again, it's so difficult to answer those questions, because when you look at that depth chart and you look at your options, 1, 2, 3, 4, and what you're willing to go up for, and then you look, you forecast and project into the future of what you can have, salary, and all of those things, sometimes you can't compromise what the game plan is at that moment. Although, you know, Kyle Lowry is a heck of a player, and you just don't know what's going to happen. But once again, this year, I think it's going to tell. When Kyle Lowry comes out and playing the way I know he's going to play and do all the things, then other teams might be kicking themselves. But, you know, other than that, it's going to be hard to really put yourself in that situation unless you see the end result. And once again, it's really hard to compromise what the game plan is, especially when you're going to the board or you're going to everybody and try to project what you have already put in place, and you try to pivot a little bit with something that's uncertain. So that's a hard question to answer, but I think if Kyle plays the way we know he can play, then people will say, you know what, I told you so, we should have did it. And you hear that a lot in the front office.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Alvin, appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, guys.
There's Alvin Williams, former Raptors guard, Sportsnet analyst. And I keep drawing the through line to Chris Paul and what he did for that Phoenix Suns team that was a good team, but not even a playoff team. They won all their games in the bubble before Chris Paul arrived, but they were not nearly a championship team. They go from that team that goes undefeated in the bubble, just narrowly misses out on a playoff spot, to adding a future Hall of Famer, same dimensions as Kyle Lowry. He's a no doubt Hall of Famer. Kyle Lowry is maybe a borderline case, and depending on what he does later in his career, maybe he's a Hall of Famer. But they go to an NBA Finals, and they end up in a regular season finishing one game back of the best record in the entire NBA. And the idea of a 6-foot point guard who's just tough and a culture setter changing your fortune so dramatically. And I've talked to Grange about this a couple of times, Stephen, about how Kyle Lowry must have been, with every incredible playoff performance that Chris Paul put forward, must have been just counting dollars on his next contract and the $90 million 3-year deal that he's getting from the Miami Heat. They're more than happy to pay it, considering the possibility of what he can bring to that team.
Yeah, and believe me, I'm not saying this is not a slight at all, but Kyle Lowry is a guy who counts dollars.
Yes, right?
He's a businessman. I love it. That's he should be, man. He's, if you're in that business, you know, and he's got a lot of miles on him, Ben. You know, he's not a kid. So and you don't know about health, but if he hasn't lost a lot when he's healthy, he looks like Kyle Lowry, right? Yeah. He still does. And so you bring that to Miami, you know, that's again, not to go too far down the intangibles road, but you know, he shows up and you know, he demands stuff of his teammates in a good way. And, yeah, he'll give him a beating heart if nothing else. I've not checked what the schedule for the home.
They don't have it yet. I was looking it up too. I was like, this is pretty late in the game to not have a schedule. The Leafs, I think, have their schedule, but that, I mean, you won't find a hotter ticket in this city than that Heat Raptors game at Scotiabank Arena, right?
I hope, and I just, you know, I hope we are at full capacity. Let's just put it that way. I hope the place is packed. I hope that we're not sitting 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
I hope that's because it'll be, and you know what? Kyle Lowry will show up and they'll do a crazy tribute and all this stuff, and then he'll try and kick the Raptors out. Absolutely.
Yeah, he'll be, I don't know, tripping Fred VanVleet or doing something. Yeah, it's it's going to be... Yeah, that'll be a moment, a historic one. And then whenever they build the statue, whenever they raise the jersey to the rafters, all that stuff is going to happen in due time for Kyle Lowry. But yeah, his return to Scotiabank Arena. The Raptors' return to Scotiabank Arena is probably not going to be unlike what we saw on Friday for the Blue Jays at Skydome. Can't wait for it. Hopefully we get a schedule at some point in the near future that we can plan our lives accordingly. I'm sure you'll be down there. It'll probably be a Sportsnet game. You'll probably do another one of those essays that makes me cry. Can't wait for that.
It's entirely possible. It is entirely possible.
All right. The Canadian women's soccer team crying tears of joy, if they were crying at all, after beating the Americans for the first time in 20 years, a rather significant victory, sending them into the gold medal match of the Tokyo Olympic Games against Sweden. We'll talk to a woman who was a part of that team that suffered heartbreak thanks to some officials 9 years ago in London. Karina LeBlanc, former goalkeeper for the Canadian national team, joins us next. It is Writer's Block. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Annis filling in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. And Thursday night, you can watch Canada's national women's soccer team change the color of the medal at the Tokyo Games. It will not be a bronze. It'll either be a silver or a gold after beating the Americans 1-0 in the semifinal game in Japan. Let's talk to a woman who's a bronze medalist herself. Karina LeBlanc, former goalkeeper for the Canadian national team, joins us on the line right now. Karina, thanks so much for doing this. How's it going?
It's going fantastic. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Very well. It was fantastic, if not gut-wrenching, to watch you react in real time to that victory on CBC. Understandably, you had a tough time keeping it together, as did all the Canadians, especially the ones that stayed up and watched that thing live. But where are you now emotionally, given a couple of more hours to separate yourself from the emotion of that moment?
I don't know if I've separated at all. No. I think I'm still on a high, but I think where I am is looking ahead to the next game. You know, I've connected with some players. It's been exciting just to be able to be a part of this moment in history and in real time and, you know, connect to the women and the team and the players, but most importantly, being Canada and just like see the aftermath of it. You know, it's no longer just our team believing and hoping that this happens. It's almost like the entire nation. So it's just fantastic.
There's Karina. Hey, first off, great work on the broadcast. You've been doing a great job.
Thanks, Steven.
There's obviously a whole lot of history wrapped up in that moment. But I keep coming back to one thing when I think about that game against the Americans. What did it take for Christine Sinclair to hand the ball to Jesse Fleming for that penalty?
You know, it's one of those things. I just got a goosebumps, but can I just acknowledge you because you've been a believer of this team for so long, so I'm just giving you a big shout-out there.
Thanks.
But I think, for me, one of the things in just watching it is you knew this moment wasn't just kind of planned in that second. You know, I think there's so many interesting moments, things that factor into that moment. I mean, Adriana French and Sink are teammates in Portland, so Adriana would know Sink very well in PKs. But also Sink knowing, you know what, I missed the one before. I have no problem being that leader to hand it over. Looking at Jesse, and Jesse's like, heck yeah, give me the ball. And it's just one of those things where I think that's one of the things about Sink is that we all know how humble she is and how in a big moment she'll be like, hey, do you want to do this or I can do this? And for her, it was just like, hey, Jesse was just so confident. Here you go. And just the magnitude for Jesse to take that PK. I mean, I'm a goalkeeper. I looked at it. First of all, I just enjoyed it in the moment. But I went back and looked at it. It was just perfect. You know, France read it right, but it just went into the corner. So I think it's almost like, I think what you're seeing on this team is, you know what, everyone wants to do it for Canada, yes, but they want to do it for Sinky. And I think that's one of the things. I mean, imagine Jesse first coming into camp, being put as a roommate to Sink when she's a young kid. This is the girl. This is the woman she'd looked up to all her life. And here she is now playing with her, a chance to make history together. And then she gets the ball for her in one of the biggest moments of her career so far. And she just nails it. I think you just see the connection and the unity of this team. And I think that's also why I believe so much going into the next game that, you know, it's not going to be the most beautiful game. We all know this. Mm-hmm. These women are tired. And I shouldn't say women. These players are tired. And, you know, it's been a lot, but, and I think Sweden's going to come in, you know, Canada's played extra minutes, but here they go. And it's an opportunity to be history makers, legacy leavers, and most importantly, I think that connection of doing it for Sink.
Yeah. Jesse Fleming, 23 years old. It's incredible the amount of pressure she must have felt in that moment for, I mean, not just a nation, but a 38-year-old sporting legend in this country, so much on the line for her to step up in that moment and come through the way she did. Makes me think about the future. Hopefully it never comes to this, and Christine Sinclair just plays till she's 60. But the next wave without her, where is the state of the program when and if Christine Sinclair decides to hang him up?
I think we've answered the question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what we've been talking about on air. It's 2012, phenomenal, right? I mean, we did what nobody was expecting us to do, you know? I mean, and going into that Olympics, you know, I say in 2008, we went to win a medal and we lost in the quarters. And to 2012, we went with, like, let's inspire the next generation with our actions and how we are. And then, you know, Canada was like, this is fantastic. And then Rio was back-to-back. This is amazing. But this team's always been about how do we change the conversation completely when it comes to this game in this country. And they knew to do that, it would mean gold medals. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're going out with one thing in mind, and they're just inspired once again on something greater than themselves. And in that process, you're seeing like that the veterans hand over the torch. You saw it perfectly, like we just talked about in Christine Sinclair, giving it to Jesse and saying, here you go. And I think what it is that it's no longer like the next generation that's being inspired. It's this generation. That generation's playing, and they're going to have that experience. You know, like this rivalry that we talked about, Canada-USA, the young players came into it like hearing about it and seeing it. They never felt it. And I think that's one of the reasons why they went into this game. They weren't intimidated. They're like, okay, we can beat you on any given day, and that's what they did.
Karina, they haven't made it look easy. I have to say that, right? They, you know, gave up the late one to Japan for the draw. They got by Chile 2-1. Go to penalties with Brazil and missed the first penalty. And then, you know, the American, obviously what happened to the Americans, but that was the only shot on goal in the game was the penalty. Talk about what they have done well in this tournament, you know, that has allowed them to get to the gold medal game.
Well, what they've done well is kept us in our seats. You know, it's like, okay, everyone, we could have done this a little easier for all of us, you know. And, I mean, in speaking with Bev, it was one of the things after the third game where she said, you know what, we need to clean up our final 10 minutes, you know, because that first goal, it was a poor goal. And then the third goal, it was like, you know what, that's just like small errors. You know, in the last 10 minutes of the game, let's clear the ball. Let's make smart decisions. Let's not try to build a ball out of the box to play and look fancy. Let's do the simple things right. And I think, you know, against Brazil, they started to do those things. And you saw probably more 1-2 passes, more movement off the ball, you know, Quinn in the middle, getting on the ball and doing big things, hitting those diags. And, you know, when Bev Friesen talks about being brave, she's not just talking about mentality. She's talking about, like, listen, when you get the ball, Desiree Scott, turn. And when you get the ball, Jesse Fleming, turn into that crowd and create those chances. Christine Sinclair, come off the front. You know, take the pressure, but create space for, you know, our wingers. And I think that's what they've been doing more, is not just being playing the safe play, but being brave enough to do things that they've all been working on to take their game to the next level. I mean, Ashley Lawrence, another player that we're not talking enough about. I mean, Vanessa Gilles, I mean, mm-hmm. Talk about being brave. You know, her eighth cap, she comes in and scores one of the biggest penalties of her lifetime, of any Canadian lifetime, acts as if she's a veteran. So I think that what this team's done is everybody's found a way to rise, and they found a way to rise as individuals, but doing what the team needs to do. And going into the game against Sweden, that's exactly what it's going to take. But I've said this, like, you know, Sweden helped beat Canada in the World Cup, knocked us out. But most importantly, like, none of those past games matter. This is a gold medal match, you know, and both of these teams won it for different reasons for their countries. But this is where these players have stepped up and said, you know what, we know if we get that gold, it's going to mean hopefully we're going to have professional soccer for women in this country. It's going to mean that next generation of young players and girls will grow up and be like, I want to be on this national team. And yes, maybe we're able to do that. And you can hear my daughter. She's going to be one of them in the background. Yeah. And yes,
that's great.
We may be able to do that, but it's going to be a reality.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. So that's what, 2040-ish range we're talking about, yeah. Karina?
Exactly. We already put it. She's already kicking the soccer balls.
I love it. I can't wait. Talking to Karina LeBlanc, former goalkeeper for the Canadian national team. So it's the gold medal game, and obviously that there's the focus turns to that. But you said it. There's still an emotional element to this that you're feeling. I got to imagine the players are still feeling it. It was such a historic moment for that program. How do you put yourself in that position where you leave that behind, the drama of yesterday, and start thinking about Sweden?
It's pretty simple. I mean, the players have come into this game and this tournament that this is a business trip, right? And I remember in 2012, that was the difference between us in 2008 and 2012. Like, this is a business trip. There's no opening ceremonies, you know. It's get in, get the result, get out. And I think Bev, after they won the penalty kicks, she was like, celebrate this, but we weren't here for this, right? We have two more wins to get. And it's the same mentality after this last game. Celebrate it, yes, but we have one more win to get. And I think it's just taken, almost like when you're a player and an athlete, you have to focus on the present time. You're not getting too far ahead of yourself or living on the past. And I think that's what this team and their mindset is that, okay, on to the next one. What do we need to do? What do I need to do as an individual? And having that mindset moving forward.
Karina, I talked to Christine right around the time John Herdman announced that he was, you know, that he was leaving and going to the Canadian men's national team. And obviously John was a transformational figure for the women's program, and he's doing a kick-ass job with the men right now. But I, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things she said to me that day was, you know, it's time. You know, it's time for a different voice. What mm-hmm. what has Bev Priestman brought to this team, to this program?
So many things. I mean, I've had the privilege of speaking to her several times throughout this tournament. And one of her first games, or the first game, was against the U.S., right? And you imagine you come in and you're like, okay, how do we press restart here? And one of the things she said is, from then, how do we change the color of that medal? And what's it going to take? And I know the term brave is a term used a lot, but that's exactly what she's done. She's instilled in these players what it looks like to be brave and how each of them need to take their game to the next level to make the team better, but also what is the legacy that you want to leave in this country, you know? And I think you're looking at a mixed group right now, because obviously this group is filled with veterans who my daughter is chasing me, and I'm trying to chase away from her in this hotel room. So she's like, Mommy, you can't talk without me. But what does it mean at this point to leave a legacy? And this is history. You know, this is history beyond just football or soccer. This is true history here. Mm-hmm. And what is the script you want to write in this history? And I think that's where she's taken this team on this journey of like, hey, like we have an opportunity here to do what's never been done. And I remember that was the same conversation John had with us leading into 2012. I mean, he's doing the same conversation with the men's team in another phenomenal way. But what Bev has said is like, you know what? I knew you. I went and I grew and then I've come back and I want to be part of like a phenomenal story. And she's the only female coach, you know, in the tournament at this point, but even in last game as well. And she's writing her own history, and I think it's phenomenal. And she's just put that sense of belief in these players, of especially going into that U.S. game. And if there was ever a time to beat the U.S., which we always went into the U.S. game going like, maybe this is the time, this could be the time. But I mean, you watch the Americans, it was like, this is the storyline and this is the time. And so she's just instilled that different kind of confidence in this team.
It'll probably be a 20-year run for the Canadians over the Americans by the time your daughter is playing on the national team, I imagine.
Yes, very true. And the big discussion, is she going to be a goalkeeper like me or a left defender and winger like her father? So we'll see.
All right. We'll be paying attention. Karina, appreciate the time. Again, I'll echo Stephen's sentiments. Great job on the broadcast, and thanks for doing this today.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate that. All the best.
All right, you too. Karina LeBlanc, former goalkeeper for the Canadian national team. Again, 10 o'clock on a Thursday night, or 11:30 if, say, you know, you live with bears in Newfoundland.
Yeah, well, the midnight oil will be burning here. I'll tell you, you know, no cheering in the press box, right? That's the rule. No cheering in the press box. And I have studied neutrality. Well, you know, that's, believe me. But it's nice, you know, the nice thing about a national team, is that you're allowed, right? You're allowed to kind of wear your heart on your sleeve. And with this team in particular, you know, again, if it's not obvious already, a lot of water under the bridge with several generations of this group. There's only one left, from that original crowd, you know, and, she's still pretty fantastic. But yeah, if you can't get behind this team, as a Canadian, check your pulse.
No, it's incredible what they've been through, what they've been able to accomplish. And Christine Sinclair, her legacy as not just a sports person in this country, but just as a person. And you know her better than anyone, Stephen. And I said it, she's 38, which isn't exactly a spring chicken in any sport, let alone one where you're running all the time in soccer. But it's just, you feel embarrassed because I think I've spoken to her on the radio and just, you feel embarrassed to even ask about it at this point because, I don't know, why should she stop? Is there another Olympic cycle in her?
She's not, you know, she's a different player than she was, right? She can't just tear down the field and outrun everybody anymore. She's playing with, you know, most of it's between the ears now, right? It's the way she sees the game and kind of can control the game without being able to dominate physically the way she once did. So, I would never say never with her. And, you know, she is one of those people. She's very shy, you know, and very private. So, as you know, she's a very challenging interview sometimes.
Yeah.
She doesn't give a lot away. But, you know, remember, you know, think back to that game in 2012 at Old Trafford against the Americans and what came out of her in that game. You know, one of the most magnificent performances I've ever seen by a Canadian athlete. And, you know, and that kind of righteous fury about the way that game was refereed and the way it was stolen from Canada. You know, the fire burns bright in her. So, you know, if she can, I'm sure she will. It would be unbelievable to go, you know, a whole other Olympic cycle here, although it's a slightly shorter Olympic cycle this time around. But, you know, one way or another, her DNA is going to be part of that team. It just will be. I'm not sure. You know, maybe she coaches, right? She has had a coaching career as well as a playing career. I certainly could see her in that role one way or another.
Yeah, hat trick 9 years ago, and then this time around handing the ball off to a 23-year-old to score the eventual game winner. It's quite an arc for Christine Sinclair, and can't wait to watch Thursday night. All right, more of Writer's Block. We continue. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brun, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis in for Jeff Blair, who has another two-hour edition of Baseball Central with Kevin Barker at 5 o'clock, alongside Stephen Brunt. And just over 3 hours away from Hyunjin Ryu making his Rogers Centre debut as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays, and also my triumphant return to Rogers Centre, but the first time without a 5- and 3-year-old, so it might be a different situation for me tonight. Game
well, you
two.
Will be with, I was going to say, you will be with Bunkus, though.
Yes, you're right. Yes, I'm not totally unencumbered, is what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get that, and there's some accuracy to that. Yeah, Blue Jays trying to get back into the win column. They need to go on one of these runs. I keep saying it, and Cleveland's not as soft an opponent as some of the ones that they will face here in the final 2 months of the season, but a team that you should beat, especially at home. You're allowed to have an off night offensively like they did yesterday. The bullpen's much better. Man, it would be so interesting, Stephen, to go back and replay those games that they lost. Not in the ninth inning. There were some that were in the ninth, but most of them coming in like the sixth and seventh, where you had to get something out of Trent Thornton. You had to get something out of Tyler Chatwood, and maybe just give up one run, maybe two. No, you gave up 5, and the game is lost. The bullpen, the way it's constructed right now, it is not the greatest bullpen in the history of the game. It's not that 2015 Royals bullpen where it was like flamethrower after flamethrower coming out. But it, compared to what it was earlier in the season, it's just so, so monumentally different. And, yeah, we'll never know. But I'm thinking the Blue Jays might be in that second wild card spot if they had this bullpen. And it's about to get better, I think. And let me know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
Because this Nate Pearson thing is interesting from a number of different respects. One is that he keeps getting hurt, and some of the injuries have not, they've just been freak. I mean, you break your elbow on a comebacker, that's not something, hey, that guy's injury prone. But there have been the groin stuff and the lower body stuff. There's some people who point to the amount of effort it takes to throw as hard as he does, and maybe something that is going to be a recurring thing with him, and he's seeing doctors with second opinions, and now he's going to return as a reliever. And last time we saw him as a reliever, he was his best. He was mowing down the eventual American League champion Tampa Bay Rays, albeit in garbage time in game 2 of the playoffs a season ago. Just what are your overall thoughts of this prize prospect, the guy who was supposed to be 2 to Hyunjin Ryu's 1 into the rotation this year? He's going to return as a reliever.
Well, you're right about the injury. Like, they haven't, it sounds weird, but they haven't been pitcher injuries, right? Most of his injuries have, like, thank God,
yeah,
right? It's not forearm tightness, right? Or one of those, or triceps something, or one of those ominous things that where you go, uh-oh, this is a pitcher injury, and this is going to be it. You know, that even though he throws as hard as he does, it hasn't been that kind of, you know, I think part of the regard Nate Pearson at this point, Jays fans, I think, is kind of colored by the way Alek Manoah arrived, right? Like, he shows up, you know, with his sunglasses and his chains and lungs from the moment he gets out there, uber confident, just mowing him down. Did it in spring training, did it in action. Looks like, now he did, you know, fall downstairs and get hurt, but looks like a guy who, you know, like, here I am, I belong here, I'm one of the guys. And, you know, Nate has at times looked like a guy on the mound where if things weren't right physically for him, you could see it in his, you know, you could see it in his performance, and you could see it in his body language that, you know, he wasn't feeling like the guy who throws 104 miles an hour. He was unsure of himself, you know, and unsure out. And, you know, all these guys can throw a baseball way better. They're all different. And, you know, it's not like, you know, that means Alek Manoah is better than Nate Pearson or is going to be a better big leaguer than Nate Pearson. But, you know, Nate's, you know, I think one of the things the team's kind of waiting for is for Nate to go out there on a day when he doesn't feel 100% and still be able to be effective.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like, I get it. Like, it's got to be a scary thing when, you know, that, like, pitching is an unnatural motion and, you know, lots of stuff can go wrong. And if you get up there and something feels weird, everybody in the world tells you, don't keep going, because you're going to make it worse, or don't keep going because that weird groin injury you have is going to alter your motion and you're going to blow out your elbow. I think it's mostly been bad luck, I guess. So that's a long way of getting around to the fact that, yeah, he needs to pitch. He needs to pitch against big league hitters. He needs to pitch in significant situations. And he, you know, he needs to kind of go through the trial by fire a little bit here. I think that's the best possible thing for him and the best possible thing for the organization. And yeah, there's no point. You can't stretch him out now again. Mm-hmm. You know what, Ben? You don't need to, right? The rotation's pretty good.
It is.
Like, that's not an area of dire need right now. You know, it's a big change. So you don't have to throw him out there and say, save us. You could use him, you know, for a couple of innings here and a couple of innings there. And like last night, you know, the rather fresh memory of last night in extra innings aside, I think the pieces are there now. You know, like I think Charlie and Pete Walker have got to kind of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the pieces are there now for this to be a good, you know, not maybe not great, but a good bullpen to go with a very good rotation. And what we've seen has been a very, very good offense, right? That should win you a lot of ball games.
It should.
I think that's the best. Look, I think it's the best possible use for Pierce. Now, if this goes haywire, you know, like there's going to be questions, you know, and part of the questions are because, you know, there's been so much fanfare and, you know, understandable fanfare. It's not just folks in Toronto that have been pumping his tires. No. Everybody in baseball has been pumping his tires.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's been the number one prospect in the organization. He's been one of the top 10 prospects in all of baseball. He throws 100. I'm more thinking about the opposite. And what if it goes extremely well, Steven? What if he does look like that guy who cannot be touched and he's, okay, maybe not the closer, even though Jordan Romano has looked very human as of late and maybe is even eventually elevated to that role because he's pitching so well and he gets an opportunity and yada, 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 yada. And the Blue Jays do have another confirmed starter in the 2022 rotation in Jose Berríos. And who knows what they do with Robbie Ray. At least they're going to qualify him. So he's going to have a decision to make as to whether he can get more than whatever the close to $20 million one-year deal that the Blue Jays offer him. Hyunjin Ryu still under contract. And there's going to be another need in the bullpen. I know Simber and Richards are under team control for next year, but a lot of these guys are the 1 year, didn't cost much to go acquire them, but are going to need to have their positions backfilled next season. I know you want to exhaust every opportunity with a young arm to make them a starter, but it's not like the numbers do jump off the page as a starter in AAA this year, or, you know, he's just, I wonder if the temptation will be there if he's just that lights out, especially the way starters are used in this day and age to have an elite level closer. If he's good in that role against major league hitters, if there's going to be a temptation to just leave him there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it can be. Said you don't surrender unless you absolutely have to. You don't say you're a reliever and with a guy who's a starter and built like a starter and all of those things they talk about and unless you absolutely have to, and it's kind of a concession. But and again, I'm not making an absolute comparison here because they're different guys, but look at Aaron Sanchez's career trajectory.
Yeah,
you know, would he have been better served, you know, mm-hmm. and again, he's about to return to the major leagues, but you know, he doesn't throw hard anymore and he's going to be, you know, desperately trying to get into that rotation, Giants rotation. I don't think he will. But would his career trajectory have been better in the long run if he had stayed in the pen, where he was very, very effective?
Yeah.
You know, you can't predict injuries. I know that. And you can't predict some of the stuff that happened there. But, you know, you wonder. It's not, you know, maybe sometimes that's, you know, it's with perfect hindsight, you know, maybe sometimes that's the best way to, you know, to max out a guy's utility. I expect next spring we're going to be talking about Nate Pearson as potentially a part of the rotation again, if he's healthy.
No,
it's 100% anticipate that.
It's a great point, the Aaron Sanchez one, because everybody does the David Price thing where it's, hey, or the Jimmy Key thing, where it was a reliever, and then, you know, he figured it out, and he was a starter after that. But, yeah, for every David Price and Jimmy Key, there is an Aaron Sanchez, or a Daniel Bard is another one, guy who was a lights-out reliever for the Boston Red Sox. Jabba Chamberlain, another one that you wonder if those guys had just been left alone to be relievers, how different their career trajectory might have looked. Either way, they'll take him if he can return at some point. Last couple of months of the season, throwing 100. When we come back, who better to look back at the life and times of Kyle Lowry as a Toronto Raptor than Doug Smith of the Toronto Star? He joins us next. It's Writer's Block. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. And Kyle Lowry is a member of the Miami Heat. That's not quite official yet, but just the I's to be dotted and the T's to be crossed. And what better guest to have on to talk about Kyle Lowry's nine-year Toronto Raptor career than Doug Smith of the Toronto Star. Doug, thanks so much for doing this. How's it going?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
Doing very well, Doug. And very much enjoyed your piece today in the Star. I wonder if you could just put yourself back in your shoes 9 years ago and look forward 9 years from then. Like, could you have believed that Kyle Lowry would have accomplished the things, become this sporting icon in the city when you first met him?
That first week in Halifax, we couldn't wait to get him out of town. And I think, and I'm telling you, there are people in the organization who felt that same way too. He didn't particularly want to be here. He didn't know what it was. He was hurt. He was cranky. The team didn't know what it was getting for sure. And my opinion was certainly shared by several people around that organization in that week.
What, Smitty? What? You know, I've been reading the reminiscences. They've been great. You know, your piece and Grange's piece, guys who, you know, what it was like kind of dealing with Kyle in the early days from the media point of view as well. He was not easy on you, any of you I could see. But what was the tipping point? Like, when did, you know, his kind of edge and chip on his shoulder become a positive rather than a negative for him?
I think when I give Dwayne Casey all the credit in the world for this. I think Kyle realized that beating his head against a wall wasn't getting him anywhere. And maybe going along to get along at some level was going to make him better. And Casey treated him perfectly. He let him rant. You know, Dwayne got bristled at him and, you know, didn't particularly like him at most times. But he sort of let him have his head and grow into himself and didn't, you know, hugely discipline him. They let Kyle mature, and Kyle, I think, finally got tired of fighting a fight that he knew he wasn't going to win. You know, if you got a kid who's wailing all the time, you let him wail, and eventually gets tired of it, and he doesn't wail anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some semblance of, I think there's a little bit of comparison there to be made.
Yeah, it sounds like sleep training. I've done that. Yeah, it works. did you get the sense that this was coming? Because I think most people said goodbye in that Nuggets game and the moment in the hallway before the trade deadline, and then they don't move him, and then you think it's eventually going to happen at the end of the season. Then they don't draft the point guard, and you wonder if maybe there's a return that can happen. Where is your level of surprise? Where were you on Kyle Lowry's future as a Raptor as we went into this offseason?
I thought if there was a way to do a two-year deal here and no three-year deal in Miami, he would have come back here. I think the third year was something he wanted. I don't think the Raptors wanted to go out that far in the contract. And when it became apparent that Miami and, you know, Dallas might have given him a third year too, then I think he was gone. I think that extra year, the extra $30 million is a big deal. And I don't think the Raptors felt comfortable paying it. And they would have welcomed him back at their own terms on a two-year deal, I'm pretty sure. But if he could find a three-year deal, good luck to him. Shake hands. We'll see you down the road.
Should there be any second thoughts about not moving him at the deadline?
I don't think so, because at the deadline, I don't think Miami wasn't really I don't think it was a legitimate option. Philly didn't have the pieces. The Lakers had nothing. You did open up the scope of where you could go this summer by not moving him. I think Dallas getting into the conversation and New Orleans getting into the conversation probably pushed Miami a little bit further than they wanted to go, and those two weren't options in April at the trade deadline. So I think holding on to him was the best idea because it opened up the group of available places for him. It ended up that he went to one of the three that we thought he would go to in the first place, but the other two, Dallas and New Orleans, I think helped get that third year on this contract.
The Raptors do get something in return. They get Goran Dragic, which we're not sure whether he has a future with this organization, and Precious Achiuwa and a second-round pick. What do you make of that return, and what do you imagine the future is with Dragic and this Raptors team?
Oh, they would like to move Dragic today. They would like to move him to Dallas. He would like to go to Dallas, but I don't think Dallas wants to give up what the Raptors want. So maybe you get a third team involved. Maybe they find another player that satisfies everybody. But I, you know, I think Dragic will not be here past the trade deadline, because he will again become more marketable to more teams at that point. And, you know, he's 34, 35 at the end, 1 year left on his deal. He's not part of the long-term fix here. And, you know, but he's a serviceable player. If they have to play half the season with Goran Dragic as their backup point guard of Fred VanVleet, they're pretty good. He's not a stiff. The guy can still play. The intriguing bit to me is Achiuwa, because here's a kid, the 20th pick in the draft last year, didn't play an awful lot in Miami, but played enough. A crazy good body, crazy good athlete, is still learning how to play the game, is sort of the multi-positional guy the Raptors kind of like. Not a shooter at all, but he's the piece, I think, with 3 years left on his contract, his rookie scale contract. He's a piece that I think is going to be very intriguing in the future. I was very impressed that they got him, because I know Miami was pretty high on him. I know Pat Riley liked him at the draft. They put him under the tutelage of a Udonis Haslem, who is a consummate professional teaching young kids how to play. And I think Achiuwa might have been locked in behind Bam Adebayo in Miami a lot, but I think he's going to be an interesting piece.
Smitty, let's talk about both sides of the equation here. What do the Miami Heat look like with Kyle Lowry? What do the Toronto Raptors, who we haven't seen without Kyle Lowry in a long, long time, you know, through various iterations, like the squad around him has changed, but he has been a constant. And when healthy, he has been consistently himself. What do the Raptors look like with a Kyle Lowry size hole in the in their
They look
roster?
Like, I think they look like a middle of the pack Eastern Division team that's two or three years away from being very, very good. They're going to be extremely young. You know, they're going to give Scotty Barnes a lot of time. Fred VanVleet's not an old man. OG Anunoby's still very young. I think Siakam is the wild card, and I don't know how his game will change, evolve. But they're a team that's built for a couple years out. And I think everybody sees that coming. The Chew is that kind of guy, too. He's a piece to go next year or the year after that. Then maybe you hit your stride. So I don't think they'll be bad. I don't think they're destined to be back in the lottery, but I don't think they will be in the top three or four in the East right now. But again, Stephen, we saw this. You guys will see this every year. When you get in the playoffs, who knows? You just got to get in there, and stuff happens. So I think they're certainly good enough to be in there, right in that middle of that 5, 6, 7, 8 area in the East. And we'll see what happens when they play for real in April.
Go ahead, Smitty. I say, what's Kyle do for Miami?
He gives them I think that team needed a little bit of leadership. I'm not sure Jimmy Butler is a grab you by the scruff of the neck and pull you along kind of guy. Kyle is. It makes them a lot tougher. You know, they added PJ Tucker too, which is another big, you know, a mean, tough guy, veteran guy, knows what it takes to win championships. Just did. Miami's—they have no depth at all. That's the big problem. They gave up a lot of pieces to move around to get the money and the players to satisfy the Lowry deal. So they don't have a whole lot of depth. But their starting five of—if they go, you know, Butler, Lowry, Duncan Robinson, PJ Tucker, and Bam Adebayo—they're pretty good. But beyond that, I'm not sure where they are, and that's going to be interesting. If you look at it now, I think they'd be in the same area as the Raptors are in the East, and an interesting team. But they're old and they know how to win, and that's going to be their blessing, I think, as the season progresses.
Talking to Doug Smith, now I imagine most of the heavy lifting has been done for the Raptors. They've been rumored to be involved in Ben Simmons. Like, how much work do you expect to still be done here?
Oh, they got some work to do. They're in no rush to do it. They don't have a center under contract. Now, I'm sure they will pick up the option on Chris Boucher. I think it's Monday or Thursday or Friday. I'm not sure which day. I think they'll kick the tires on guys like a guy like Hassan Whiteside still out there. I think they'll re-sign Ken Birch. They have pieces to fill in, but it all is going to stem from if they can turn Dragic into anything. And that's still up in the air. And until that's resolved, everything's sort of on hold. They won't know how much money they have to spend. They won't know whether they have what kind of salary cap. This is all salary cap minutia that drives me crazy and makes my head hurt. But they won't know if they're an above the cap team with a full bed level or a below the cap team with a room exception. So they got to wait till the Dragic thing is fully resolved before they know exactly what they have to spend on who they have to spend it on. But I would expect Birch to be back. and Boucher in the next little while.
Smitty, just going to change course here just slightly. It's, you know, you're somebody who's covered Canada basketball since I was a boy. You better. sometimes I was there with you. This has been a rough few. This been a rough few weeks. You know, going back to the qualifying tournament in Victoria where the men didn't make it, and then having the women bow out in Tokyo far earlier than I think any of us anticipated. Just kind of let's talk about the women, because I know you had high hopes for that side. All of us did, and it did not pan out for them. What do you think happened?
I think they got a really crappy schedule and a really bad break in that first game against Serbia. And if they win that one, then they're free and easy and they get into quarters and who knows what happens. But losing that game really put them behind a big, big eight ball. Spain is, probably the second best team in the world. And they just didn't beat them in the third game. The Serbia loss, that first half of that first Serbia game, which, I love this women's team. I love the women as people. I love them as athletes. I think they've done a remarkable thing for young women basketball players in the country for a decade. So I'm a little bit cloudy on this. They didn't play very well in that first half of the Serbia game. And I think part of the reason was the first time they'd played together in 17 months. They had flown three WNBA players in 6 days before the Olympics began and needed them to hit the ground running, and they hit the ground jogging in a costume. They win the Serbia game. They beat Korea. They're in the next round. Then who knows what happens. I do think they could be top three or four in the world, but they didn't win the one game they had to win. And if they started the season, if they started the Olympics with Korea and then played Serbia, I think you're looking at a different outcome.
Unfortunate for sure. Before we let you go, Doug, it's the story that we expected to be a massive story, and then it got bizarre, and then it got, I guess, inconsequential because he's still doing the job. Masai Ujiri does not have a contract extension, to my knowledge. Maybe they did it under the cloak of secrecy. I have no idea. Like, what do you make of the Masai last month or so doing his normal job and not having a public contract extension?
I think he's just sitting back laughing at us now.
Yeah, he must be.
Now it becomes farce. Like, everybody I talk to in the organization and around the league, he's doing the job as hard and as just like he's never leaving. I never thought he was going to leave. I still don't think he's going to leave. But it's not done until it's done. And we all know until it's actually signed paper, nothing's done. I don't think he's going to go anywhere. He hasn't stopped working. He hasn't stopped trying to do what he thinks is best for this franchise. But now it's become now it's comical. Now it's just joking. Now it's like, okay, it's going to happen. And they're going to send out a 2 o'clock, like a 4 o'clock on a Friday press release. And that's going to be the announcement.
Guess that makes as much sense as anything else.
Throughout this whole process, absolutely, that's a way to do it.
That'd be perfect. Doug, really enjoyed your work today. Always enjoy your work, and thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime.
There's Doug Smith, the Toronto Star. I cannot imagine, again, like Doug imagining 9 years later he'd be having these conversations about Kyle Lowry. I can't imagine that as this offseason started and so many think pieces about the future of Masai Ujiri and how much of the offseason oxygen it's going to take up, his potential extension, how long is it? Is it a shorter term one so that he can get out of it somewhat early? Is he going to join some new expansion team? Is he going to get out of basketball entirely? Like, nothing. We've heard nothing. Nope. All he's done is the job he's always done, except this potential contract extension. I imagine it's been offered. Maybe there's a back and forth, but we don't even know that, Stephen.
Maybe it's working month to month, right? It's like, you're like a lease, right? If you sign a lease and then after that it's month to month. I don't know. I've said the same thing all along. I can't imagine a scenario where maybe give him whatever the heck he wanted. Maybe barring a piece of the team or equity in the team or something. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe there is a point where they would say no. But I can't, like, really, it's one of those things where, just give us your list of demands and we will accede to them, right? Like, that's what you would think. And the only scenario under which you would think he would leave would be to get you know, an ownership stake somewhere or to go on to greater things than basketball, right? Like, that's why, yep. Where would you rather be, right? He likes, seems to like the city. He's got full control over the organization. He won a championship. He has the resources to do pretty much whatever he wants to do. Why would you go work for, you know, James Dolan or somebody like that? Because your life would be worse. So it all, you know, logically, it's always kind of pointed to him coming back and just kind of deciding how many zeros are involved in the contract. So it is a great mystery. And Smitty may be right. He may be just playing with all of us right now. You know, they may just slip it out on a Friday afternoon press release one day, you know. But he seems to be still doing the job. So,
yeah.
I'm not sure any of us predicted it would play out this way, but yeah, maybe that's part of the point.
No, but that's it. So he's doing the job, and I guess it could play out in a way that makes me feel differently, but he's done so much for this organization. He's been a part of the planning for 20, 21, 22 to such a degree that there's almost, like, the idea of him joining another organization, the NBA, is almost icky at this point. Like, that cannot be... It can't be a possibility. The only possibility that he's not, in my mind, a member of the Toronto Raptors organization next season is if he's out of basketball entirely or in like a league office type position. Because, I mean, he was there for the drafting of Scotty Barnes. He was there for the decision-making in the trading away the greatest Raptor of all time to turn around and then what? Take a job with the Dallas Mavericks after that and you know, the potential of a Goran Dragic being traded to Dallas? Like, that's... I think that's untenable.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with all of that. You know, so unless there is a higher calling, I would think you would have to... that's actually a good point. That to go, going through the draft and going through free agency... You think to some degree you have agents, right? Otherwise, it's a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty clear conflict. You can't work for, you know, you can't end up working for two teams. So, I like everybody else, I assume he's sticking around. But until they tell us he's sticking around, and then, they may just be, they may be having some fun with this. But if I cannot imagine a conversation in which Larry Tannenbaum or whoever it is that speaks for Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment would say to Masai, no, we're not going to do that.
Right.
I'm not sure how would that conversation happen? He's got more equity and built up than any front office, you know, in Toronto, where we do fixate on front offices, as I pointed out a couple of times, but like, has anybody ever had more cards to play than this guy?
Like, no.
Anybody running any team in Toronto sports history? I don't think so.
No. It's just been unlike any scenario. And I played out a few scenarios in my head when this was going to be an off-season storyline. Never thought this one would play out where it's like, yeah, it's fine, but there's no contract certainty and we're very much into the off-season and here we are, Masai Ujiri just flailing around in the wind. We got potentially good news for Andre DeGrasse this morning because I watched last night, and I don't know how into the Athletics you've been, Steven, but Andre DeGrasse is...
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it too. I really do need more just people racing against other people in my life. It's just simple to understand, and it takes 20 seconds. Or if you're Andre DeGrasse, less than 20 seconds. Because he runs his first heat late last night, and it was not exactly awe-inspiring. It was well over 20 seconds. He had the inside lane. Donovan Bailey told us on the broadcast not to worry, and he was right because he runs the semifinal of the 200-meter this morning in a Canadian record and is in, I guess, the favorite position to win his first-ever Olympic gold medal. We will talk to the aforementioned Donovan Bailey, two-time Olympic gold medalist, next. It is Writer's Block. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Writer's Block, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Anderson for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. Jeff Blair, Kevin Barker. 2-hour edition of Baseball Central at 5 o'clock. We're going to talk to Donovan Bailey in a couple of moments here, Stephen. But, yeah, I was just saying it before the break. Andre DeGrasse highlighting the men at these 2020, which has now turned into 2021 Tokyo Games. And for the first time in a long time, the 100-meter final was wide open with Usain Bolt retired. It's just, it's staggering to go back and look at the times that he put up and the world record of what, like 9.54? Still 0.3 of a second away from the gold medal winner from Italy this season. Ends up with another bronze medal, Andre DeGrasse does, in the 100-meter final. But he was thinking very hard about winning a gold medal in the 200-meter. He, of course, famously finished second to Usain Bolt 5 years ago in Rio, and they raced against each other in the heats, and he had the great picture of the two and Bolt looking back at him. I was a little freaked out. I was a little bit concerned when he failed to post a sub 20-second time in his first heat, but I am buoyed right now. And you know what? We have Donovan Bailey on the line right now, so let's ask him. Two-time Olympic gold medalist, still the Canadian record holder in the 100-meter, and he's Oakville's own. He is Donovan Bailey. How's it going, Donovan?
It's a great day, fellas. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing better since I heard you on CBC calm me down after DeGrasse doesn't break 20 seconds in the heats, and then he throws down a 19.73 in the semi. Thank you for that.
Well, never you worry. A big part of the problem, seriously, is that, you know, I have definitely the great opportunity to kind of educate the public on kind of how professional track and field works. Here's what happens. Andre, after he did a personal best in the 100 meters, your body almost gets flat. So it almost like, no matter how much effort you put into a race, you're just not going to have that pep, right? So I knew that he was going to be all right. And he was just running to make sure that he got a lane. I mean, he really wasn't, although if he put a lot more effort in, he might have got hurt. But I knew that when he knew he was in, getting home, resting, getting some therapy, sleep, some good food, probably called his mom and his partner and his kids. And next day was going to be a different story, man. So yeah. No problem. Keep watching. He's going to do some things. He's going to do some things.
Oh, man. I want to talk about him. One comment on the 100, though. I want to ask you about that, Donovan, before we move on to the 200, where Andre's headed. But, you know, did you have Marcel Jacobs in the pool? Because I didn't, going into that race, although it was you. Did you think he was the guy, well, a guy this year going into the Olympics?
Well, going into the Olympics, no, but I'm just saying to you, he definitely didn't come from anywhere. And the other thing is that I was watching him, you know, from the rounds. The thing about Marcel, he's a big guy. And what's crazy is that he got comfortable really quickly, and he got comfortable without the spotlight being shining upon him. So in the finals, one of the things I'd said was the race was going to be between Curley and Lamont in the middle of the track. But I thought that because both of those guys were going to be together, that one of them might tie up, or one of them, or both of them might make a mistake. And so Andre being on the outside, I definitely thought he was going to be the spoiler. I thought that Andre was going to, if Andre had the same start that he had in the heats, he would have been the Olympic champion in the 100 meters because he executed excellently, man. I knew that. I didn't know that Lamont Marcel Jacobs was going to run that fast. He did run. He's the European 60-meter champion. He ran 6:47 indoors. So, calculating that, I mean, the time that he ran is no surprise.
So do you think 3 years from now, he's 26, Andre DeGrasse, and let's stick on the 100-meter because I think he's the gold medal favorite all of a sudden in the 200-meter, and right, not surprising considering he's the silver medalist with Usain Bolt in the field, and he ain't there. But in the 100-meter, he runs a 9.89, He's 26. Mm-hmm. 3 years from now, like, how much improvement can you imagine? That's a personal best for him, and he ends up with the bronze. How much improvement is there left for DeGrasse in the 100 meter?
Oh, tons. I mean, I think that one of the things that we all need to recognize that I love the fact that people are spending a lot of time talking about Andre's times this year. His times are really relevant to me. One of the things that he's done in every single race is work on his biomechanics have drastically improved over this year. Obviously, his consistency coming out of the blocks and his ability to execute. I mean, so he's going to continue to do that, as well as he's going to hit the weight room at some point, which means that his first 30 meters out of the block is going to improve. So there's always, with professional athletes, professional sprinters, there's always room for improvement. So you're always going to be tinkering with things, diet changes, weightlifting, thinking about his race scheduling, doing more twos, you know, whatever. But, Andre DeGrasse still has a ways to go in improvement, man. He's an awesome kid, and I only wish him good health, as he continues to climb.
Donovan, can you talk a little bit about what kind of a guy he is? Because I've been watching. Obviously, he's the star of many television commercials now. God love him. but I always think of there's kind of a sprinter personality type. No slight, right? But this is not a slight. But it requires an enormous amount of self belief to do what you guys do. And I think of you, and I think of Usain Bolt, and I think of a lot of American guys sprinters. There's right. kind of it's an individual sport, and there's a high degree of obvious confidence. Let's put it that way. And he doesn't seem quite like he doesn't seem quite like the same kind of guy as, and maybe that's just a veneer. He seems kind of self-effacing for a sprinter. Like what's he like?
That is a beautiful veneer. That is a beautiful. Listen, here's the thing. With every athlete, you're gonna always have different personalities, right? And one of the things I love about Andre, he's a giant killer. He'll smile at you and he'll take your heart out. So, I mean, maybe I'll smile at you and take your heart out, but I mean, at some point I'm going to be serious, right? Or Usain was the same way. Usain will tell you, hold up, be quiet. I'm about to take your heart out. But Andre, any athlete at the highest level in any individual sport, frankly, any person that is successful on this planet has to have, some level of edginess. And believe me, Andre is someone who is confident and believes in his own abilities.
So is he the favorite to win the gold medal in the 200 meter, in your opinion?
He was my favorite before you guys saw the first heat. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the 200, at the end of the 100 meters, I'm like, all right, he's fine. Because, I mean, obviously, his ability to get out of the blocks, essentially slingshot across the turn, where he'll generate top speed, and then he's the person that decelerates the least in the sprints these days, in the 100 and the 200. He's the person that decelerates the least. He actually is at his best when he's, like, relaxed and at top speed. So, yeah, I believe that if Andre does not win the gold, he would be upset.
What is it? The obvious differences between the two races, between the 100 and the 200, Donovan. But what makes a great 200 meter runner? Is it different than what makes a great 100 meter runner?
Well, first of all, it's twice as far. So I mean, the possibilities of making mistakes. For all you math people. Right. But the possibilities of making a mistake, in 100 is obviously you have a shorter time to correct. And also you got to have hellified power come out of the blocks. The start sets up both races. Mm-hmm. And so, Andre made a mistake. I saw mistakes. I mean, I want him to come on and tell you guys about the mistakes that he did. But I saw mistakes in the finals up to 100 meters. Now, if he makes the same mistakes in the deuce, he will be able to catch them and pass them. So that's why he's my favorite.
So he runs the 100. Aaron Brown decides not to run the 100, even though he qualified for it. He is also into the 200-meter final. How unusual, though, is it to have two heats of 200 meters in the same day? Because they run the heats, and then they run the semifinal just hours apart.
Well, it's been that way. I mean, that's what the program has been for a couple of years. So running, basically, it's two runs.
Yeah.
You know, so one of the reasons why it is that you see guys conserve their energy in the heat, in the first heat anyways, is that. You know, so, you know, it's very important for you to understand how to manage your own energy, you know, and your own speed. Because we saw what happened in the 100 meters with Bingtang Su, you know, and with Ronnie Baker. So, you know, again, you can shoot your shot, but make sure you shoot your shot, you know, when there's a, you know, when there's some hardware to be had at the end of the race.
Not looking past the 200 for sure, Donovan, but, you know, looking past the 200, how do you feel about Canada? What do you, how's the 4x1 looking for you right now for Canada?
Well, you got two guys. First of all, it looks amazing. I know that my boy Glenn. I know that my boy Glenn Roy has probably been doing baton work, especially for those two other guys who did not make the 100 meter. They didn't get out. I don't think they got out of their heats.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very certain he's working them hard, making sure that there's a precision in which this baton, fragile baton, is held and passed. So I mean, I'm going to send a note to him, and I'm going to send a few choice words to these guys. To let them understand, man, that we're in a place right now where this is their greatest opportunity to get to the finals and to get on the podium, so they better take advantage of it. So our chances in the relay are amazing. The Chinese team's gonna be like, there's gonna be a bunch of teams that are gonna come from that you guys are not gonna hear about before. So I mean, the Japanese team's gonna be excellent. The powerhouse teams we know are always going to be, you know, Jamaica and the UK and the USA, but China, Japan is going to be excellent. Trinidad and Tobago is going to be excellent. So Canada has a great chance with you got two sprinters that are top top 10 in the world in their events, and hopefully I see Aaron and Andre on the podium in the 200. I'm looking forward to the relay too. So you're definitely not speaking out of turn. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being optimistic and confident, and so we can see these kids doing their thing and hopefully hearing the national anthem of Canada play.
Yeah, in the heat and humidity. Talking to Donovan Bailey, because they keep talking about how hot it is, and the distance runners, not big fans, but they keep talking about how the sprinters love it. Like, is there a temperature and a humidity level in which that's not true, or is it the hotter and the more humid, the better?
I love that hot and muggy that you could even chew on it, man. I mean, essentially all you got to do is, when I left here and I went to Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, we were training and it was like 90 degrees with like 1,000,000% humidity. And then I went from there to Austin, Texas, and some days we're training with 100 degrees, 110 degrees. And all you got to do is stay hydrated because everything around, like, first of all, it's very easy for you to stretch and for you to, you know, kind of get the elasticity in your muscle, it comes very easy. Like, all you have to do is continue hydrating. Sprinters love hot, muggy weather. And also, Tokyo is at altitude, you know, so the air is a little thinner. So again, I tell these kids, man, take full advantage because get there, run your best times. You don't know when that's going to happen again or when there's going to be such great conditions. The sprinters love it. The sprinters love hot, muggy. not so much for the distance then. Sorry for the distance, guys.
I don't think Mohamed likes it quite as much, but, you know, like those guys, they're working hard, man. I feel for the distance guys. How, Donovan, how would you have felt running in an empty stadium, do you think?
You know, I don't know. I definitely ran in a couple of meets. I mean, I ran in Sarajevo. There wasn't a lot of people there. The first meets in Doha, there weren't a lot of people there. But I think that for me, the focus would have been the situation at hand. I mean, I'm talking to you guys about the opportunity that's presenting itself to these kids and this opportunity may never, ever, ever come again. If I was competing today, I would think about the gravity of the situation and how important it is. So my focus would definitely be on winning and executing. But it's awfully strange to see, you know, Vahum, like, probably run the greatest track event in the history of the world, and there's nobody there. Like, you see Marcel Jacobs, you know, being the first Italian to cross the line, and the only person that there is, like, is a few camera guys and his teammates. I mean, my God, listen, it's after you win the World Championships and the early Olympic Games, which I've been blessed to do a few times, you have probably 50 cameramen on the track, alone. And then you probably have 3,000 media, 3,000 to 4,000 media people, and then a stadium with 100,000 plus people, as well as the entire planet looking at you. My God. So that's just a different kind of high. And I mean, I don't know, you know, again, how I'd feel. I mean, I'm very certain that I'm someone that would be focused. But yeah, it's definitely tough to when I watch these kids and they can't celebrate, kind of like how we did, because you know you're essentially focused on your race or on your event, and then you pass the line, and all of a sudden you've got the big stadium, whoa, that sort of thing, and these guys don't get it, man. And I actually thought that what they were gonna do actually was they were gonna pipe in music like they do for UFC or you know boxing or whatever. I thought they were gonna pump in audience music, because I'm very certain, you know, we got technology would have allowed us to do that. But no, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's really sad, and I'm definitely looking forward to, you know, the World Championships next year, and hopefully there's a full stadium, and you know, and things are back to normal, and these guys continue on their quest to be great.
Yeah, fingers crossed that we can have the feeling something close to what we felt in 96 when we watched you in 984, which is etched in all of our brains. Donovan, absolute pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
It's not a problem, guys. Take care and cheer on the guys. They're having it tough with a couple of the American guys, but cheer on the Canadians. Thank you.
Yeah, always will. Donovan Bailey, two-time Olympic gold medalist and still the Canadian record holder in the 100-meter. 984, still standing up. Steven, that's like one of those numbers in this country that I'll never forget.
Yeah, that was quite a night. That was quite a night. And the 4x1 in 96 was quite a night, too. So fingers crossed on, well, I'm feeling, it's hard not to feel good about Andre de Grasse in the 200. He just looks so comfortable.
Yep.
Not to jinx him here or anything, but... Then let's go on to the 4x1. And, you know, we talked way back earlier in the show about what it felt like when Canada beat the Americans in the women's soccer. when Canada beat the Americans in the 4x1, that was pretty sweet. And they are the great nemesis. I know there's other countries out there, but that's still that's the sweetest of them all. So I'm hoping. I hope they can pull that together at the last day of the Olympics.
Yeah, I can't wait. We have an answer to what is the corresponding roster move for the Blue Jays with Corey Dickerson being activated. We'll tell you what it is. We'll react to it next. It's Writer's Block. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Block of Writer's Block. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair. He'll be alongside Kevin Barker. Another two-hour edition of Baseball Central. Ross Atkins coming up after 5 o'clock alongside Stephen Brunt. And Stephen, teased it before the break.
Mm-hmm.
Hope you didn't cheat. Find out what the answer to the question was. What is the corresponding move to Corey Dickerson being activated? That's fine if you did. It's, Kevin Biggio on the IL with his neck and back issues that have been kind of a recurring theme for him, apparently something he's been dealing with all season long. It's an interesting timed situation because he has played rather poorly, and Santiago Espinal has played very, very well. What do you make of this season that Biggio's having?
It's been tough to watch, to be honest, yeah. Because you see the frustration, and Kevin is a guy who, like, I think you alluded to this way back in the, earlier in the show about, he wasn't, despite the last name, he wasn't an obvious major leaguer. He's a guy that kind of defied his draft status and prospect status and worked his way to the major leagues. He works really hard, and you could see, the frustration in him. He hasn't been, he hasn't looked like the best of Kevin Vigio. And again, I'm not sure what he is. I don't know that anybody fully knows what he is, but he is definitely their second best defensively. He's not their best option at third base right now. Mm-mm. And he's also not their best option as a left-handed bat. Like we'll see what Corey Dickerson is, but even if Biggio had stuck on the roster, Corey Dickerson was going to get some of his at bats. So it's, it's kind of convenient. And that it's worked out this way. And maybe it's a reason, part of the reason why Kevin Biggio hasn't looked like the best of Kevin Biggio this year. I honestly don't know. And, none of us are close to the team this year, so we don't, or haven't been up until now. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll see how long this lasts. I'm thinking a lot of these IL stints at the end of the season, Ben, are going to conveniently last to the 1st of September when they can expand the roster.
Yeah, that's generally the way it works. It's. I've been a fan of Kevin Biggio, even when he's hit, 250 or sub 250, because the on-base percentage has been so high, because he can run mm-hmm. into one every once in a while, and he can play all over the diamond. He's not a guy that I think you have to or should necessarily play every day, but that's fine. That's a nice rosterable player, especially when rosters are 26 men. But it's hard to deny how well Santiago Espinal has played, and offensively he has a pretty clear ceiling. Like, there's no power there. And there's not a ton of on-base skill either. But as a minor leaguer, I think he hit 280. And how many above-average defenders does this Blue Jays team have? Marcus Semien, he's not playing at his best defensive position. George Springer. And Vlad Jr., honestly, has played like an above-average defensive player. If you're not getting a ton of offense out of that position either way, I think it'll be interesting to watch Santiago Espinal play every day.
Well, when a ball, if you watch a ball game, see a ball hit to him, how do you feel? When he's throwing it across the diamond, how do you feel? You feel pretty good, right? The ball hits Vladdy right in the letters every time, right? He's very consistent.
Yeah, not to be said about a number of different defenders that have played on that side of the diamond. But yeah, he's played well. And the bat is matching the glove a little bit recently. See how long that lasts. Like I mentioned, Ross Atkins coming up on Baseball Central after 5 o'clock, two-hour edition. Jeff Blair and Kevin Barker. We'll be back tomorrow. You've been listening to Writer's Block. Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair alongside Stephen Brunt. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.